Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
We're not scientific at all. Pass by trees, flowers, fields of corn. We don't even see it. The white supremacists go to the bottom of the ocean and study one grain of sand, bring it and put it under a microscope. The black person passes by and say, "What are you doing there, Ralph?" "See, I'm studying this grain of sand that I got 8,000 feet from the bottom of the ocean." "And what are you studying a grain of sand for?" "I'm studying it because it's there. And I'm going to find out why it's there. And I'm going to find out everything about it. How it got there, what it does while it was there, what it can be used for by me." To dominate you. That's how my mind works. Well, how long are you going to study it? As long as it takes to figure out how I can use it to do a job on you.
The Pentagon is funding some new research on insects and plant viruses. It says the goal is to protect agricultural crops. Some critics say it looks more like an attempt to make biological weapons. Here's NPR's Dan Charles.
Jane Polston and I are walking over to some greenhouses at the University of Florida, where she teaches. She wants to show me how viruses infect plants, which she's been studying ever since she first learned about plant viruses back in college.
I just fell in love.
With viruses?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
We step inside the greenhouse. There's a smaller chamber here with walls of netting, and there's six tomato plants inside. They don't look too healthy. The leaves are wilted.
This is our tomato yellow leaf curl virus colony.
The tomato leaves look like they're covered with dandruff. But when Polston reaches in and moves a plant, the white particles come alive. They're tiny flies, white flies. They're also infected.
Because they're reared on these infected plants, I think probably all of them will have virus in them.
One of Polston's colleagues scoops up some of the flies and puts them in a cage with a healthy, uninfected tomato plant.
If you look carefully, you can see some of the white flies landing on the leaves.
And as soon as they start feeding on that plant, they're going to infect this plant with the virus.
Yeah, within about 15 minutes.
Polston spent years studying this triangle of insect, virus, and plant so she could figure out ways to disrupt it and stop the viruses from harming crops. But now she's getting ready to carry out a very different kind of experiment in a different greenhouse, a super secure one that they wouldn't let me go see. What's going on in that greenhouse is the brainchild of Blake Beckstein, a program manager at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. He thinks there's a way to use this infectious triangle for good.
I thought, you know, this is a beautifully elegant system that puts genes into plants that causes negative effects. Why can't we turn this system upside down and use it to deliver positive traits into plants?
Beckstein is giving money to Polston and several other groups of university researchers. Each one's using a different combination of insect and virus. The viruses will be genetically modified so they can carry a new package of DNA. genes that can help the plant, maybe help corn survive a drought.
If a drought is coming, we could actually use the insects to deliver viruses that carry with them the payload, that drought tolerance capability.
And the insects are supposed to be genetically altered too, to make sure they all die off after they accomplish their mission. But all this talk of genetically modified insects delivering payloads sounds disturbing to Silja Wernicke, a law professor at the University of Freiburg in Germany.
We asked whether the peaceful purposes of the program are sufficiently clear and plausible.
The stated purposes don't make a lot of sense, she says. If you're trying to protect your crops, just spray them. Why resort to genetically modified insects and viruses?
It seems much easier to harm a plant with a technology than to make it more resilient.
You could imagine using insects and viruses to destroy somebody's crop, she says. And that is prohibited under the Biological Weapons Convention, which the U.S. and most other countries have signed. Blake Beckstein from DARPA says those suspicions are not justified.
We are not developing biological warfare agents. This is for the benefit of crops and the stability of our food supply.
The virus-loving scientist in Florida, Jane Polston, says, no, we're not making weapons. But new technology can be used in lots of ways, which you often can't predict. Dan Charles, NPR News.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night. News said they did $1 million worth of damage. Every black person was watching that like amateurs.
Hello, I'm Jim Wilkie. Welcome to Jazz Northwest, our regular Sunday afternoon survey of the regional jazz scene from Portland to Vancouver. We have several new ones from Portland on today's show. This next one is a very ambitious project by Ezra Weiss, a composer whose original songs and short film scores are included in a new album about Oregon's blue-collar black history. From Maxville to Vanport is the name of the CD, and it celebrates the history of two towns along Oregon's northern border that reveal distinctive viewpoints of the state's underrepresented black history. Now, don't look for them on the map, because they're not there anymore. Maxville was a logging town built in 1923 and shut down a decade later in 1933 in Wallowa County, Oregon's northeastern extreme. Vanport was built in 1942, just north of Portland, for shipyard workers. It was destroyed in a matter of hours by the flooding Columbia River in 1948. Both towns were multicultural communities that housed workforces with significant African-American and immigrant populations at a time when many Oregonians were openly hostile to them. Among the homesteaders, loggers, and ranchers who were Oregon's early settlers, black Americans played vital roles as needed laborers, despite being legally barred from living in Oregon by the state's constitution. From Maxville to Vanport connects two blue-collar, multicultural communities that existed decades apart, but tell an important story about the Great Migration in the Pacific Northwest. Looking honestly at the prejudice these people face, the album celebrates the resilience, courage, and important contributions to Oregon through a variety of styles of music, jazz, R&B, and blues. Music was composed by Ezra Weiss, with lyrics by poet S. Renee Mitchell, and is performed by the 12-member Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble that often sounds much bigger than 12 pieces through judicious use of orchestral woodwinds and more. Vocalist Marilyn Keller is featured very prominently. The album as a whole is due for release in the middle of this month, but the opening title track was issued as a single last month, and we'll hear it now. This is titled Oregon Sounds Like Freedom. The Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, music by Ezra Weiss, Marilyn Keller is the vocal soloist.
Oregon sounds like freedom. Sounds like freedom. No!
freedom, freedom.
Wait a minute, y'all. The bees are feeding day to day to day. They say no other way. This stuff is really bad. I'm talking about.
This is Lucy's house, and I'm going to show you what happens to families when one of their members becomes a basehead. Now, basing is crazy. I mean, it makes you go crazy and make you do silly things. Look at the family. The family is crazy. Look at the kids. Look at Lucy over here. Lucy is going through problems because her husband is a basehead. And this is Lucy's wash pot right here. This is the wash pot. And this is also the cooking pot. And her children are going crazy.
It's common to use opioids during childbirth. They're administered in epidurals and during C-sections. Women are often sent home with a bottle of pills. For most women, it doesn't become a problem. But for mothers recovering from addiction, a pain-free childbirth isn't so simple. April Domboski from member station KQED explains.
Nicole VM says when she was in her early 20s, she made a lot of mistakes.
I was really sad and I didn't want to feel my feelings. And I turned to the most natural way I could find to cover that all up and started using drugs.
She got into opioids.
Prescription pills, heroin for a little bit of time.
Her family got her into treatment. Nicole had been sober for 9 years when she and her husband decided to have a baby. This was something she wanted to feel. She told her doctor if she needed an epidural, she didn't want any fentanyl in it. She didn't want to feel high.
Because I'd remembered seeing, like, other friends and stuff. They'd used it, and they were feeling good and stuff. And I didn't want that to be a part of my story.
Epidurals are usually a mix of two types of medications, a numbing agent and a painkiller, usually fentanyl. But addiction expert Dr. Kelly Pfeiffer says it's easy to formulate one without the fentanyl.
There's no medical reason why someone should be forced to be exposed to opioids if they don't want to.
Pfeiffer says there's another issue for women who are in active treatment for opioid addiction and taking methadone or Suboxone. Some other narcotics commonly used for pain during labor can immediately reverse the effects of those treatments.
And suddenly you're in the middle of labor, which is already painful, and now you're in the middle of the worst withdrawal of your life.
Control 2, Battalion 7's responding to Sutter Hospital area.
For Nicole VM, it was the worst wildfire in California history that interrupted her birth plan.
There was a ton of smoke in the hospital. Like, you could visibly see it outside and smell it.
She was in active labor when nurses said everybody had to evacuate. VM was transferred to another hospital 5 miles away, and the special instructions for her epidural got lost in the chaos.
And then when they went to change the drug, I saw the tube said fentanyl on it, and it was by that point I was starting to feel the itchies.
One of her familiar signs of starting to get high. Then VM needed a C-section, and doctors sent her home afterward with a bottle of Percocet, another opioid. Expert Kelly Pfeiffer says in a situation like this, ibuprofen would have been fine.
Any parent will tell you there's nothing more stressful than the first week of being a parent and having a baby and being in sleep deprivation. And here you have a little bottle of Vicodin that you used to turn to make you feel better when you're stressed.
First the fires, then the fentanyl in her epidural, then the Percocet. It was VM's first test, seeing how her sobriety and motherhood would line up.
I was okay. I was okay with it. It just was something that had happened.
She called a friend who's also in recovery and talked it all through. She said the Percocet could have sent her down a rabbit hole, but it didn't. She was fine leaving that behind.
You know, a lot of people metaphorically felt it as the baby coming out of the ashes, you know, the life coming from the ashes and stuff. And I feel that. I feel like it was a big time for our community and me personally to be reborn in some way, you know?
She says taking care of Adrian this past year has taught her how to take care of herself. For NPR News, I'm April Domboski in Santa Rosa.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Damn you, Obama.
And big time, Juan, they are coming to his defense, not only students, but teachers as well, and parents as well. Behind me is the scene where it happened, Maywood Academy High School, the scene of that punch that has certainly, well, not heard around the world, but certainly heard around the Southland. As you mentioned, he was arrested, posted his $50,000 bail, got out of jail on Saturday, and now faces charges when he goes back to court November 30th. But as far as support goes, well, it's hands down for this teacher. It was a vicious right to the jaw in music class that sent a 14-year-old student sprawling. The man who delivered the blow, 64-year-old Marston Riley, the music teacher at Maywood Academy High School.
I just want to know if he's okay.
If he's okay?
Yeah.
You're concerned about Mr. Riley?
Yes.
How about the student?
The student, I don't really care about him.
And nearly all the students we talked to sided with Mr. Riley.
All the racial slurs of that kid, that kid was just being very disrespectful.
He's really calm, and he really respects his students, and he cares about his students a lot.
This is Marston Riley, and I'm letting you know that this GoFundMe page is legit.
On his GoFundMe page, Riley thanks all those who have contributed to his GoFundMe page. The contributions are getting close to the goal of $50,000.
I would have done the same thing.
Really?
Yes.
The daughter of this woman had Mr. Riley as a teacher last year.
Wow. Us as parents have to learn how to teach our kids how to respect teachers and older people.
How's you holding up? Nothing whatsoever? I mean, we understand he's getting a lot of support. Do we like to, you know, come to the door and just thank the people?
A woman in a very soft voice behind a closed door at Riley's Anaheim home said, quote, Mr. Riley has no interest in talking to anyone. Thank you. No comment. On the cell phone video, you can hear the 14-year-old calling Riley names, referring to him as, quote, bro, using the N-word and other racial slurs. He throws a basketball at Riley. Seconds later, the punch. This student said she was in the class that day.
Do you blame Mr. Riley?
No.
Not at all?
No, not at all.
And this statement from the Maywood Academy faculty, quote, many Americans saw for the first time the deterioration of respect for teachers. It goes on. We have created an environment where disrespect, bullying, and intolerance can thrive. We were told Riley has taught at the school for 7 years, and from what we learned, he's respected by both teachers and students. Mr. Riley is what the school district calls on home detention. In plain English, that means he's been suspended with pay until further notice. And we don't know how long that will last. Until further notice is what the district would tell us. Also, in their statement from the faculty, they made it very clear that they are asking the DA in Los Angeles, Jackie Lacey, not to press any charges against Mr. Riley. Reporting live from Maywood, I'm Dave Lopez, KCON News.
All right, Dave. Thank you.
Recent acts of violence, the shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue, the explosives sent to critics of President Trump, happened in the real world, but the warnings took place online, on social media. On this month's All Tech Considered, we look at toxic content, how it spreads, and what should be done about it. The Pew Research Center says 97% of boys and the vast majority of girls play video games. Increasingly, they're playing online with strangers. Although it's rare, experts say these games can become an avenue for recruitment by right-wing extremist groups. NPR's Anya Kamenetz has our story.
John's a father of two teenagers, and he said he never worried about his son's video game habit.
I knew nothing about any of this until one night I'd walked into my home office.
We're not using John's last name to protect his family's privacy.
I was shaking when I saw it. I'm like, what in the world is this, and why is this in our house?
He saw a pile of papers face down next to his printer. He turned them over and found a copy of a notorious neo-Nazi propaganda book.
It's white culture is in trouble, and we are under attack by Jews and blacks and every other minority. It was scary. It was absolutely frightening to even see that in my house.
John confronted his son angrily.
And then I went back to my room, and I honestly was crying. I felt like a failure. that a child that I had raised would even be remotely interested in this stuff.
Like millions of other kids, John's son loved first-person shooter games. It's increasingly popular to play these games online and form teams with friends or strangers.
There wasn't anything obvious to me at first because it's common. Online gaming and chatting with friends online, that's the norm now, instead of going out and hanging out at the drive-in or whatever.
And it's this way, John says, that his son started hanging out with avowed white supremacists. They keyed into his interests in military history and Nordic mythology.
He was now in the in crowd with these guys.
John learned his son had been drawn into at least one group that the Southern Poverty Law Center calls a Nazi terrorist organization. He searched online for help and found it.
Christian Picciolini, founder of the Free Radicals Project, author of White American Youth.
Picciolini is a heavily tattooed former skinhead. He's now dedicated his life to helping people move away from hate.
We are assembling a team of people around the world to help people disengage from violent extremism.
30 years ago, he says,
you had to meet somebody to be recruited, or you had a pamphlet or a flyer put on your car and you reached out.
Today, he says, it's much more common for extremists to reach out online. And that includes over kids' headsets during video games.
Typically, they'll start out with dropping slurs about different races or religions and test the waters. Once they sense that they've got their hooks in them, they ramp it up. And then they start sending propaganda. They start sending links to other sites, or they start talking about these old racist, anti-Semitic tropes.
Gaming culture is one of the spaces of recruitment that must be addressed.
Joan Donovan is with Data and Society, a research institute. For years, she's been tracking white supremacists from platform to platform online.
They were really trying to figure out what young men were angry about and how they could leverage that to bring about broad-based social movement.
And first-person shooter games, chat rooms, and video platforms, she says, are good places to find angry young men. Video games are $100 billion industry. So what are companies' responsibilities to ensure that teens won't encounter hate groups? Greg Boyd is a lawyer who represents the game industry for the firm Frankfurt Kernit. He says companies take the problem seriously and remove or ban people when they're flagged by other players. But the scale of the issue is daunting.
You're talking about Microsoft, PlayStation, and Steam, you're talking about 48 million, 70 million, and 130 million monthly active players or players that are playing, you know, probably on a weekly basis. I mean, that's the populations of Spain, France, and Russia.
Imagine, he says, moderating all that chat, text, and voice, moment by moment.
In literally every language, dialect, and sub-dialect spoken in the world.
While the industry struggles to contain the threat, experts say it's up to parents to keep an ear out and to step in if they notice something that concerns them. John tried, and lately, he says, his son, now 16, seems to have left these ideas behind. He's playing fewer online shooter games, and on his own, he started attending church. Anya Kamenetz, NPR News.
Hop on the mic and like, make it cooperate with the rhythm. That is what I give them. Reagan is depressed, but I voted for Shirley Chisholm.
50 years ago on election night, Shirley Chisholm became the first black woman ever elected to Congress. As we continue our series on the events of 1968, NPR's Walter Ray Watson takes a look at Chisholm's victory and her legacy.
Shirley Chisholm's election in 1968 barely registered with media at the time. Richard Nixon's narrow win of the White House dominated headlines and airwaves, and few people outside Brooklyn, New York were paying attention to a black woman's campaign. It wasn't until months later that the country started taking notice. An NBC News camera crew filmed Chisholm on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, fielding questions from students visiting from her district.
How do you feel being the first black woman, you know, in the House of Representatives?
I have mixed feelings. First of all, I'm very glad to have been able to make history in this country by being the first black woman. And boys and girls, as far as I'm concerned, actually, it's overdue, so I don't get terribly excited about it.
This is from the network's 1969 documentary, a half-hour called The Irrepressible Shirley Chisholm. Ebony Magazine also put her on their cover. But even as she got more press, she found herself fighting for her voice in Congress. Here's what she told Tavis Smiley on NPR back in 2003 when asked which was a bigger obstacle, her race or her gender.
I met far more discrimination being a woman than being black when I moved out in the political arena. all kinds of meetings and all kinds of groups got together in order to stop me from moving out, because I was very outspoken, very articulate, and I didn't take any guff from anybody.
Chisholm left a teaching career to enter politics in 1964, winning a seat in the New York State Assembly, where she helped pass unemployment insurance for domestic workers. She then set her sights on federal office. Once in Congress, she fought for a Head Start, an early education program. She also advocated for the Equal Rights Amendment and co-founded the Congressional Black Caucus as one of the original 9 members.
There are people in our country's history who don't look left or right, they just look straight ahead. And Shirley Chisholm was one of those people.
President Barack Obama posthumously awarded Chisholm the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2015.
When Shirley was assigned to the House Agricultural Committee, despite the fact that her district was from New York City, she said, apparently all they know here in Washington about Brooklyn is that a tree grew there.
The point is, Chisholm from the very start refused to be sidelined in Congress. She demanded and got moved to the Veterans Affairs Committee while the Vietnam War was still raging. In 1972, Shirley Chisholm made history again, running for the Democratic Party's nomination for president. Ayanna Pressley is one of many who cite Chisholm as inspiration today. She's poised to become the first black woman to represent Massachusetts in Congress.
Shirley Chisholm said she simply wanted to be remembered as a black woman who dared to be herself. When more of us do that, we win.
In Georgia, Stacey Abrams, another black woman, is trying to make history in the governor's race there. She says she's proud to be part of Shirley Chisholm's legacy. This is a record year for women running for governor and for Congress. Walter Ray Watson, NPR News.
Polls. If we believe the polls, on November the 6th, a political earthquake is coming. Reporters are almost breathless with tales of blue waves and transformation from one party to another. But if such predictions seem so sure, remember the elections of 2016, when polls proved woefully inadequate. Predictions fell like yesterday's lottery tickets. For polls, ultimately, are snapshots in time, and they can prove fallible to something as simple as the weather. Rain and cold temperatures can depress voting, as the hardiest dare to brave the winds or weather of fortune. We are witness to the politics of fear and hatred of the other, them. Those who are not us, but who are we, if not them? It is interesting to see and hear of invaders to these shores. For to the indigenous First Nations, all who now inhabit America, with the possible exception of Africans, are invaders, the refuse of Europe. Here, they slaughtered millions of so-called Indians to make Lebensraum, German for living room, for so-called whites. Politics, that great machine of division, can call the people to fear and enmity, or it can call them to unity and common purpose. Time will tell which will prevail. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Was invoked from Barack Obama. I am not prejudiced.
President Trump calls the migrant caravan traveling through Mexico an invasion. He wants to end birthright citizenship, he says, by challenging the 14th Amendment. At the same time, hate crimes are on the rise, and people are talking about what is fueling them. NPR's Sam Sanders sees race as a through line shaping our politics and current events. And he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sam, the election is in just 2 days,
it's
been another brutal cycle, and the rhetoric is really intense. What do you hear?
What I hear and what I see and what's been the case for me for, gosh, 2 or 3 years now is that we are all having these conversations about big news of the day that dances around race and never really engages with it. I think for me, the biggest example this week was President Trump's comments about possibly altering the 14th Amendment, which we know guarantees birthright citizenship. And so, you know, the history of that amendment is rooted in race. And I think a lot of folks have been reluctant to talk about that. But this amendment was passed for black people to give slave descendants the right to be citizens. And so we cannot talk about this adequately without talking about the racial history of the amendment. But even that is not enough.
Why not? Explain.
You know, even besides the history of this amendment, if you trace the origins of the Trump White House's push to change it right now, the people in Trump's orbit and the hardliners on issues like immigration and citizenship, they have been talking about this stuff in very racialized ways. And they've basically been making the argument for years now that something must be done about immigration and borders and who gets to be a citizen. I'm talking about people like Steve Bannon, former White House advisor, who was very influential in all of Trump's views on immigration and who is a citizen. He infamously said a few years ago that he thinks that there are actually too many brown CEOs in Silicon Valley. Jeff Sessions, who was Trump's attorney general, he previously praised a law from 1924 about immigration that was meant to end, quote, indiscriminate acceptance of all races. So we have examples of people in Trump's orbit who are shaping these policy positions that are talking about race. And so if we don't also talk about race, we're not telling the whole story, and we aren't giving all the context needed for our consumers to make sense of this stuff.
On the one hand, you're saying we should talk about race, we should call it what it is. But on the other hand, some journalists are saying, actually, we don't want to shine the spotlight on this because basically changing a constitutional amendment is so difficult, it's impossible. This is just another one of President Trump's gambits to kind of move the conversation, shift the conversation, and sort of energize his base. And the more we talk about it, the more oxygen we give it, the more we're sort of playing into his strategy.
You know, I can recall the time when Donald Trump tweeted some interesting things about trans people in the military, and everyone said, oh, he won't do it. And then he did. You know, I think there is a reality that even if a court finds what he's trying to do unconstitutional, he can still implement some order until a court says no. It can still affect people, at least temporarily. Mm. And so when I hear journalists say we should ignore it, it just feels like a really privileged thing to say. If you are on the margins in this society, you can't ignore it. If you're undocumented, if you're waiting to be legalized, you cannot ignore when the president says that he could change the 14th Amendment. You know, I think for us in our industry right now, we have to separate reality from distraction, but we should also be really clear in talking about the history and context and the through lines of these stories. And we have to put ourselves in the minds and shoes of the people who are most vulnerable and who would be affected by these policy changes.
We've been talking about identity politics, Sam, for the past couple of weeks now. And as you know, there is research that says that people are often exhausted by conversations that tie back to race. You know, it often gets lumped in with this idea of, quote, political correctness. And we know that it's not just white people who feel tired of it. It's also people of color who feel tired of it. So how do we talk about race in a way that allows the most people into that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to start with us asking more questions and not trying to act as if we have all the answers. Whenever I talk to real people in the real world, if you listen long enough and hard enough, they will start to talk to you about race. I will never forget, I was talking to a voter in Iowa last election cycle. We were talking about why he was going to support this person or that. And within just a few minutes of me just asking him questions, having my mic open, he started to tell me about how he believes that America is a country that is just created for white Europeans. And I just sat there and listened, and then we kept talking about race, but I only got there by just being quiet and listening. And if this Iowa voter can tell this black guy right here, me, myself, his deepest, darkest thoughts about race, it just proves that people are willing to talk about it and they want to talk about it. We just have to open up the conversation in ways where they feel comfortable doing so.
Sam Sanders is the host of the NPR podcast and radio show It's Been a Minute. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, first ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
Let's turn now to our own Yamiche Alcindor at the White House. Yamiche, we reported earlier on the president's forcing out his Attorney General Jeff Sessions. We've been trying to understand what happened. What do you know from your reporting? Before I ask you about the election, what do you know from your reporting about the decision to ask the Attorney General to go?
Well, Jeff Sessions' firing was really a long time coming. President Trump, for months, was railing against Jeff Sessions. He really blamed Jeff Sessions for why a special counsel had been appointed to look at the president's campaign with connections with Russia. The president really looked at Jeff Sessions as someone who was a thorn on his side. He wanted to fire him for a long time. The one thing that was really surprising to White House aides that I talked to was the timing of when he announced that he had fired Jeff Sessions. He had that long press conference where he was talking to dozens of reporters, answering all sorts of questions, but he didn't break the news. He did say that he could fire anyone he wanted, but White House aides said they expected the president to talk about Jeff Sessions there, and he didn't do it, so he broke the news after.
So, Yamiche, let's talk about the election. We just heard the president in that report commenting on some ways that he might be able to work with Democrats, and then other ways where there could be a problem. What are you hearing from your reporting?
Well, the president embraced bipartisanship with a big caveat. He said, Democrats, I'll work with you if you don't investigate me. That's a big deal because Democrats are already signaling that they want to look at the president's tax returns, that they want to look at whether or not there was any sort of violation, any sort of obstruction of justice when he fired Jeff Sessions. So the president is already saying, hey, if you Democrats keep down this road, I'm not going to work with you. But he did say that on infrastructure, on health care, on trade, and on the environment, that he could maybe see himself working with Democrats. And this, of course, newly Democratic-controlled House that's coming soon enough.
Finally, Yamiche, I want to ask you about something. You asked the president a question today at the news conference, and let's listen to just part of that.
On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that the president... That's such a racist question.
There are some people that say that now the Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I don't know. Why do I have my highest poll numbers ever with African Americans? Why do I have among the highest poll numbers with African Americans? I mean, why do I have my highest poll numbers? That's such a racist question. Honestly... I mean, I know you have it written down.
Yamiche?
That's a racist question.
Yamiche, tell us what was going on there.
Well, the president really, his tense relationship with the media was on full display in a rare way today. The president had been talking to other reporters and really railing against them. He called reporters rude, hostile, unfair. Those were reporters working with CNN, NBC, other networks. By the time I posed my question, the president had been pacing at the podium just moments before. He was already kind of hyped up and amped up and really frustrated with the media. And the president is on the defense because he doesn't like talking about his rhetoric. He doesn't like that there are some white nationalists who are supporting the president. But that question that I posed today was very timely because just today, Patrick Casey, a leader of Identity Europa, which the Southern Poverty Law Center says is part of the alt-right and white nationalist movement, tweeted that he was at the White House today. So as the president said that the question was racist, and he was literally having white nationalists at the White House. I've posed the question of Sarah Sanders, why was Patrick Casey here, and who was he meeting with? Who invited him? I haven't gotten a response from the White House yet, but that's really, I think, something that people are looking at and are very concerned that there are white nationalists walking around in the White House, as the president says that just asking about them is racist.
Well, you were doing your job as a reporter, and Yamiche Alcindor, we thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
Well, tonight I also want to talk about some uncomfortable truth. The truth about who really carries out domestic terror attacks in this country. Earlier this week, I made some comments about that in a conversation with Chris. I said that the biggest terror threat in this country comes from radicals on the far right, primarily white men. That angered some people. But let's put emotion aside and look at the cold, hard facts. The evidence is overwhelming. A recent report from the Government Accountability Office shows that. Even though more people died in attacks connected to Islamic extremists, the vast majority of deadly attacks in this country from 2001 to 2016 were carried out by far-right violent extremists. The Washington Post, in writing about this today, cites a 2017 report from the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund. It found that far-right plots and attacks outnumber Islamist incidents by almost 2-1. The Anti-Defamation League says that homegrown extremists of all kinds killed at least 372 people in the U.S. from 2007 to 2016. Right-wing extremists were responsible for 74% of deaths. Left-wing extremists were responsible for only 2%. The nonpartisan think tank New America looked at attacks in this country after 9/11 and going up to the attack in Charlottesville. They found that of the domestic terror attacks, those not carried out by jihadists, 68 were by far-right groups. Only 8 were by left-wing or black separatist groups. So let me break that down for you even further. Their analysis shows that for every 8 deadly attacks by right-wing extremists, there were 1 by left-wing extremists. Those are the facts. So people who were angered about what I said are missing the entire point. We don't need to worry about people who are thousands of miles away. The biggest threats are homegrown. The facts prove that.
New at 6, a St. Louis City firefighter under fire, accused of writing a racial slur on social media. Tonight, that comment is having real-world consequences. 5 on Your Side's Jasmine Payute spoke with the group who brought the allegations to light and the firefighter who made the post.
If you feel it, keep it to yourself. But once you say it, once you act out on it, there will be consequences.
Fireman Dennis Beckman is currently under investigation for writing this under a St. Louis TV station's Facebook post. Here's part of it. Sounds like something an N-word would say, not a respectable black man.
Nigga!
It goes on to say, I work with plenty of black men that I trust my life with on a daily basis, and I doubt that this would come out of any of their mouths. Beckman was referring to an article about CNN anchor Don Lemon, who called white men the biggest terror threat in the U.S.
I think the use of the word is enough, regardless of what he said after that.
The St. Louis Fire Department first learned about the post last week. The chief launched an investigation, and a spokesperson tells me they began, quote, disciplinary proceedings. I asked if the department had decided on a punishment or if Beckman is currently on leave. I was told it would be handled internally.
He's a fireman, so it's unacceptable.
Reverend Daryl Gray works as the community liaison for the Ethical Society of Police, the group that brought Beckman's comments to light.
And when they reveal themselves, then we will call it out and we will challenge it.
He says after multiple calls to the city's public safety director, the group was told Beckman was reprimanded and placed on some sort of leave. The department spokesperson says he cannot confirm or deny that information.
Reach Mr. Beckman by phone late this afternoon. We spoke for several minutes and we wanted to share his side of the story with you. But he says the fire department told him he could not make any public comment. The city of St. Louis has a social media policy in place for its employees. Among other things, it says they should not post content that disparages a person's race.
A West Virginia official who posted a racist message about First Lady Michelle Obama has now been fired from her job. Pamela Ramsey Taylor was a director for the Clay County Development Corporation, and she wrote this online after Donald Trump was elected, and I quote, "It will be refreshing to have a classy, beautiful, dignified First Lady in the White House. I'm tired of seeing an ape in heels," end quote.
First ladies are famously circumspect about how they weigh in on politics, if they do at all. And it's rare that we hear any of them give opinions about the current occupant of the White House. But President Trump has changed a lot of norms in our politics, and former First Lady Michelle Obama does have thoughts about that. She lays them out in her new book. It is called Becoming, and it goes on sale next week. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben from our Washington desk has read the book, and she joins us with a preview. Hey, Danielle.
Hey, Rachel.
So I understand Michelle Obama does talk about her own reflections of election night when she found out along with the rest of America, that Donald Trump had won that election.
Right.
What does she share?
Well, she shares that she was shocked, like a lot of Americans, that Trump won. She, of course, had been, you know, stumping for Hillary Clinton. But she also denounces, you know, Trump's birther campaign. She talks about things well beyond election night. Hmm. She makes it pretty clear, very clear, that she has heavy contempt for the current occupant of the Oval Office. She talks about how not only was she offended by the birther campaign, where she where President Trump suggested that, you know, her husband was not born in America, but also that she saw it as a threat to her family, that it was enabling, as she says, wingnuts and kooks, that she was afraid that people could come after her children. She was genuinely scared. Aside from that, she talks about her utter fury at the Access Hollywood tape, that infamous tape where President Trump was caught on tape talking about grabbing women by their genitals. I mean, I do want to be very, very clear here. This is a minuscule sliver of this book that she spends on Trump. It's a handful of pages. It's way at the end. So if you pick this book up and you're expecting a bunch of sick burns against President Trump, that's not what this
it's
book
not what
is.
This is. It's, no. I mean, it's a memoir, right? Like, she hasn't done this before. This is about her life story.
Yes, it's really very much about telling her story, despite the fact that we all know her as the wife of the man who was the most powerful man in the country, if not the world. I mean, this is a book about this very accomplished woman saying, you know, hey, this is me. This is my story. So we hear about her childhood, her family, her college years. And through all that, we get this deeper sense of who she is than we all got while she was in the White House. We learn that she's driven. She's an obsessively hard worker. She's a planner. She's very type A to her husband's, you know, sort of more loosey-goosey way of doing things. And some of the most interesting things about her formative years are her observations on race and class. This is what I found fascinating. She talks about, you know, growing up black and working class on the south side of Chicago. And then she ends up at Princeton, this very white, very privileged place. So she talks about meeting black students who are more privileged than her to end up in this sort of bubble of very rich, very privileged people. It's all very fascinating. And it's her not just talking about policy. It's her talking about, here are broad American themes. Here's how they have affected me.
Right. Anything else stand out to you? I mean, this has been getting a whole lot of hype, this book.
You know, to me, there's a theme that runs throughout the book that I found that really gets very profound. She writes very eloquently about the difficulty of marriage. I mean, she writes about going to couples counseling with Barack. She writes about their fertility struggles, about agreeing to let politics hijack their lives. And it's clear she's not trying to be juicy here or like to dish. You get the sense she's really wrestled with deep questions about what it's like to weave your life in with someone else's.
Right. Things that, I mean, so many of us grapple with.
Absolutely.
Like the work of long-term relationships.
Right.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you so much for giving us a preview of that book.
Thank you.
It's Michelle Obama's new memoir. It is called Becoming.
But also that she saw it as a threat to her family, that it was enabling, as she says, wingnuts and kooks, that she was afraid that people could come after her children. She was genuinely scared.
And now to some of the day's other non-election news. The man accused of sending pipe bombs to prominent Democrats and critics of President Trump appeared in federal court in New York today. Cesar Sayoc had been transferred from Florida, where police arrested him late last month. He was ordered held without bail today. Sayoc faces 48 years in prison if he's convicted on 5 federal charges.
What are your thoughts a day after the election, Dr. Dunn?
Well, my feelings are, I think, more tantamount than my thoughts at the moment. We are heartbroken here in Florida. Many, many millions of us are very heartbroken over the result of this election. There is no question but that Mr. Gillum's race was the deciding factor in this loss.
It's DeSantis basically calling Gillum a monkey. I mean, it just, I thought, no, Americans are better than that. Turns out I was wrong. And in Florida, they were not better than that. And it appears in Georgia, they were not better than that. So, because, I mean, look, they couldn't have made it any clearer. They said monkey. They said monkey. And I thought, you can't win. No way. Maybe you win in like a smaller state that's really reclusive and, you know, and deeply conservative and deeply red, right? But in Florida, which in my lifetime has been a toss-up, you're going to be that over-the-top racist with, and you got Latinos, you got minorities in Florida, et cetera, and you're still going to pull it off. But they did. They did. I guess I deeply underestimated the racism that still exists in this country.
Yeah, and I don't know how. Because just even you're listening, just listening to you say that, I'm like, I feel like we don't live in the same country.
Yeah, no.
But
no,
but who do you mean, you and Cenk?
Yeah, that is fascinating. But you're not the only person who says that. But, you know, more often the people who don't say that look like me. But, like, we've been saying this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For, like, this, I could,
Like, I mean, you know, I could here in beautiful liberal L.A., I can get followed around in a store or pulled out. Like, what?
Yeah.
So, I guess well, I don't.
But so I think that a different way to say it is that because I think Jack wouldn't be is not surprised to hear that. And I'm certainly not surprised to hear that. You just thought Florida would overcome that. It's like because really what we're talking about is numbers. We're talking about, again, 35,000 people whose vote you needed to switch, and then Andrew Gillum would have won. And then we don't talk about it, because in the end, this is a zero-sum game, and there are winners and losers. And it is still what does get me, and maybe it makes me as it will surprise you and as much as what Cenk said did, is that I didn't think it would work politically as effectively in Florida. I agree. I thought... But I also thought, like, a 7-point lead and a 5-point lead in two major polls with high ratings were enough. But still, there are places where, and you thought after two terms of Barack Obama, that maybe it didn't matter or it didn't apply as much, where people will still say, you know, I'm going to vote for a black candidate, and then they don't do it.
At what point is Florida, like, officially considered just a red state? And no longer, you know, a purple state.
Well, I mean, look, Anna, so that's a fair question because they keep voting for Republicans. Right. On the other hand, it was a 1-point race. It's not like, you know, DeSantis won by 12 or 17. He won by one.
But it's not like it was a 1-point race between two reasonable people who have some different perspectives. I mean, we're talking about someone who is just openly and transparently not just racist, but he supported everything that Trump did. I mean, the thing that shocks me the most. I'm not surprised about the racism in a state like Florida. What I am surprised about is that the last 2 years have been so tumultuous for everyone, right? And you know, when it comes to the economy, when it comes to those tax cuts, when it comes to everything that Trump has done, when it comes to the environment. By the way, Florida approved a ballot measure that would really regulate offshore drilling. Because they care about the environment, they care about climate change, they see the impact of it, right? But Trump has rolled back all of these environmental protections. DeSantis specifically ran a campaign that focused on how much he loves Trump. He can't, you know, stop himself from filleting Trump. And so, like, the fact that people voted for that, it amazes me, right? Like, it's been tumultuous, and you've voted against your best interest based on how you voted on these ballot initiatives and other things. But anyway.
You're not, it hasn't been tumultuous for everybody. It's
really?
Been tumultuous for us.
Right.
But nobody, actually, you're wrong. Okay.
No,
so it has not been tumultuous for me. Like, I'm chilling. Like, JR and I were talking about this off camera. Like, are we affected by this? I'm doing well, right? Like, I have a great job. I'm not worried about my health care. I have great employer provided health care. Like, if I look at my life and I only think about myself in a super greedy way, I'm doing really well. But for the people who are living in the rural parts of Florida, they're not doing well. For the farmers in the middle of the country, soybean farmers, you know, who have been affected by Trump's tariffs, they're not doing well.
But the fact is, I hear you on that. I didn't mean us necessarily specifically, but there is a, you know, he's not that unpopular. I mean, his poll numbers, we have a tendency here, and other progressives do as well, and we find that worst poll number and we quote it. Mm-hmm. But he's like at 44%.
No, he is. He's at 42.
And then he was 44 2 days ago in the Washington Post.
I saw him at 39. I saw him at 44. But overall, he's clearly at 42 in the average of polls, which is, to me, shockingly high. But we have to keep it in perspective. That is really, really low. That is why this voter turnout thing is the key. 42% is the lowest that a president has gone into a midterm election ever.
Right, but there is
As long as there's been polling, they should have gotten killed.
Right.
But turning out your base works. That's the conclusion I draw.
Right, yes, okay. Also, economy that 70% of people think is working. 70%. The economy is booming. We don't think it's working for everybody. It's not working for everybody. The truth is, it's not working for everybody. But 68%, I think, is the number who think the economy is working. So this is an explosively good economy with record low unemployment and a president who still somehow, given us, imagine how bad he'd be if the economy were terrible, right? The flip side is maybe he is immune to everything. And he will always be at 42, 43, or 44, or 41, or 39, or 45, where he's been.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
I'm done predicting things about him. We don't know how to cover him. We don't know how to talk about him. And we don't know how to fight him. politically.
Yeah, look, you're overstating it. Look, the Democrats flipped the House. And so it would have been great to have Gillum win that victory. Mm-hmm. And it's devastating that he didn't win. And it would have been great for Beto to win. But Kris Kobach lost. Walker's probably going to lose. They've got a lot of losses across the board. Let's not overstate things. So I'm talking about Florida specifically,
yeah,
because
that's what I'm talking
about. Yeah. So in that case, no, Brooke, you're right. We do live on in two different worlds, and it's not just me and you, but it is also me and you. So like earlier in the show, we were covering a story about evangelical voters and of different races, and a stat we didn't get to is very telling about this. They asked white evangelical voters, do you think that there is, are you worried about something? I don't have it right in front of me right now, but it was something along the lines of police abuse against minorities in this country. And 71% thought, and again, I don't, not positive that's the exact number because it's not, notes are not in front of me, but right. It's in that ballpark, said, no, that's not a real issue, right?
Right.
And they asked African-American evangelical voters, and they're like, 85% of them said, of course it's a real issue. Right. Of course it's a real issue. They're both highly Christian evangelical voters. The only difference is black and white. And from their perspectives, in a sense, they're both right. What do I mean by that? Those white evangelical voters never saw the police abuse. They're not black, so they never experienced it. So they just can't comprehend it. And yes, there's also the issue of the cops do that abuse to protect us from them.
Also, right. I'm scared of them too. So I'm glad right. The cops are protecting us yeah. from the big black monster. Like that's really, I think that's, there's and more there's of that, it is that than
there's also that. There's also that. But why do 85% of blacks think that it exists, even among evangelical voters?
Well,
because it exists, because right. they lived it, because right. they lived it. They experienced it. They experienced it day to day. So it is hard for me who, I grew up in New Jersey. Yeah, you know, I was born to a Muslim family. I'm agnostic. But people can't really tell what my race is. And I grew up in a really multicultural city where there, at least as far as I could see and that I experienced, there really wasn't almost any racism. Maybe there wasn't, I just didn't see it.
There was none.
No, I'm sure there was. But it really was a very multicultural city and, right. and community and culture. So I can't quite believe, at this late date in the year 2018, I can't quite believe that there's that many voters in Florida that thought, yeah, I'm going to vote for the guy who called the black candidate a monkey. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't believe that. I can't believe it. But you got to believe it. It just happened.
But
this happens every day. This is the world that we live in. And I think just as a country, we don't do a good job of listening to black people in all aspects and just really internalizing what's being said. I mean, an open racist got a syndicated TV show on ABC. Another one got one on NBC. And then we have this all over the president. I'm talking about Roseanne and then Megyn Kelly. People are racist everywhere. Like, and they get these great opportunities all across the board. People struggle with accepting black people being experts on anti-black racism. Mm-hmm. People just struggle with that in this country.
Yeah.
And it's hard, especially for people who feel like, you know, like they're allies. Like, I'm not a part of that. And that when Obama was elected, it was like, wow, this country's really divided. And every black person in America is like, where you been?
I still think.
What's going on? And so even now it's like, even if it was flipped and he won, we should still be having the same conversation that, because it was so close that
right.
half yeah, the people who voted, even if he won by one, right, yeah. that's the problem, he should have won by 99.
Exactly.
You right. know what I mean? But that's just not where we live. So I'm not surprised. I'm disappointed because, yeah, and it does affect me. It's different. I don't live in Florida, but like to be a black woman in America and different, you know, from you people, it's very clear what race I am, yeah. like when I walk in the room. Mm-hmm. But like yeah. to be a black woman in America and the governor of a major state like that calls us a monkey, yeah. you know, like that affects your mental health of black people all across the yeah. country. Like it's not something that you can just like sit back and say it doesn't, you know, affect you. And it's so normalized that people who are on your side don't believe it. Like it's really that bad. It's really that bad.
Mm-hmm. We are, I think, to what you said, Brooke, that like the trickle down theory post Obama is unquestionably still here. Like the number of people who couldn't bear that, among them the president of the United States, is why, because that's what he pushed, right? That's, and it wasn't just, it's all brown people, black people, whatever this guy is, people, right? Right? Close enough, you know, the olive people, yeah.
How terrible.
Right? Whatever. So all of that still worked. And the fact is, Cenk, as you said, we're going to win, the Democrats are going to win 32, 34, 35 seats, something like that, probably at the end of the night. That's what the prediction is in the House. Democrats turned out. So did they. By the way, he's at 44%. So enough of that.
Oh, my goodness.
43.6. And more than the number being 42, and it'll be 41, or tomorrow, by the way, it'll be like 47. It'll get up. This will be a nice little
thing. The point is, it's not one.
Right, but whatever it is, even if it hits at 42, it stays at 41. I'm not sure that he's not immune from a real sink. And whether it's at 39, 100% of 39 are into it, mm-hmm. right? Clearly, they're into it. As you said, they come out, they respond to what he said. It worked in Florida. It's going to work in Georgia. We had two progressive African-American candidates who would have been dynamic, game-changing influences for states that are, for various different reasons, a little backwards, right? And both of them, unbelievably, with insufficient and ultimately weak and or corrupt candidates running against them, both are going to be defeated.
Also, though, in 2018, just to put it in perspective, when you talk about the two, you know, black candidates, they also would have just been the fifth and sixth black governors in the 50 states. Like, it's not.
Yeah,
it's
that is amazing. Or
they would have just been the fifth and sixth.
Yeah, that's amazing. So one real last thing here, which is that, look, I don't. It's not only about race, and I don't want you to take away that impression. Because in the same state, Rick Scott likely to defeat Bill Nelson by a very similar margin, and there was not as much of an issue about race in that particular contest. Okay, so and then those are similar numbers. So it's not like all 50% that or 51% in Florida that voted, they vote are all racist, and they all voted for DeSantis because of that. But he did call the guy a monkey. That should have eliminated him. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're a decent person, that should have been enough to at least get you to go, well, I mean, I like Republicans, so maybe I'll vote for Rick Scott. I mean, that to me is like insane, but I get it. You're a Republican, you're a right winger, you like to punch yourself in the face economically. I got it, right? So you vote for Rick Scott, but you said, yeah, I'm okay with him calling black people monkeys. All right, I want that guy to be my leader.
That is racist, and I know that it's that people struggle with that. Like, because I get it, being called a racist is much more offensive than actually living the life of one.
Right.
But that is racist. Like, the fact that someone in 2018 running to lead an entire state would call a black man a monkey on national television, and if that doesn't just completely disqualify, you have to block out everything else. If you can't do that and you don't want to do, I mean, I don't struggle with calling you racist, because I think that it's not the only thing. This affects, I bet if we study just one person who just swears to you, that's just like, no, I forgave him for that, but there's this and this and this, that there are 1,000 other examples of racism in their life. That I just don't believe that you get to pick and choose, like, when racism bothers you or not.
Yeah, just wanted to prefix tomorrow's program. It should be very interesting down here. There is hopes, quote-unquote hopes, have been regenerated on the political activity, or professional voting activities, has been reinvigorated to black people, that they have some kind of hope, because votes have been misplaced, and primarily the brunt of the blame is going to be on a non-white black female by the name of Dr. Brenda Snipes. Something similar is taking place in Georgia also. Whereas the black female who was running for governor is basically stating that I am not going to concede until hell freezes over, I guess. So tomorrow's program should be interesting.
Meanwhile, protesters in Florida are denouncing Brenda Snipes. You saw that, split the screen with them there. I should have explained that to you. People going crazy. The Broward County Supervisor of Elections.
Supervisor of Corruption!
So who is Brenda Snipes, and why is she provoking such a strong reaction? Why does she still have a job? Lisa Booth is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Voice. She joins us right now from undisclosed location.
Brian.
I just saw you, Lisa. Why aren't you in the studio?
I'm in D.C. visiting family.
All right. You're supposed to check in with me with that. So, Lisa, who is this woman?
Well, to your former guest's comment, she was appointed by Jeb Bush in 2003, but she is a Democrat, and she has been elected ever since to the position of the supervisor of elections for Broward County. Now, Broward County is the second most populous county in the state. It is also the most Democrat as well. And it's not just Republicans who have been critical of her either. The Miami Herald called Broward County the most controversial department of elections in Florida. So she's also received wide criticism from all around, really dating back to even 2004, where she failed to send out, I think it was something like over 50,000 absentee ballots from individuals who had requested them. But also just look at what happened in this year alone. A judge just ruled that she was in violation of public record laws from Florida for not fulfilling Rick Scott's campaign's request. You also go back to May, and a federal judge found that she was in violation of both state and federal law for illegally destroying ballots in regard to a 2016 primary between Debbie Wasserman Schultz and a Bernie Sanders guy who sued. And mind you, the destroying of these ballots happened in the midst of a lawsuit she was facing regarding public records requests regarding those ballots. So that's kind of sketchy. And then you also go back to August, and a judge ruled in favor of the Florida GOP that she was privately looking at absentee ballots so that they couldn't be contested or looked at by other people. A judge ruled in favor of the Florida GOP regarding that. She's also gotten in trouble for releasing voting information 30 minutes prior than the closing of the polls.
And that was 2016.
That was actually the same primary where she got in trouble for destroying the ballots with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So there's been a whole, a whole thing, even dating back to 2004, that she has received criticism over. And it's not just from Republicans.
Lisa, not only is she doing a bad job, almost anybody else in the state could be doing a better job. So I asked the governor's office, I said, why isn't she fired? And they said it's a lot harder to fire somebody if they're elected. So it's much more complicated than, let's say, you or I. We can get fired right away, But I guess it's a little different there. Bottom line is, that's where the focus is. It's an extremely blue area. You cannot blame the Scott camp for being worried.
Final thought? Well, he could have removed her for incompetence. There's precedent for that. The person that was in that job before her was removed for that very reason. My understanding is that's not really the approach of the, Rick Scott administration. But I think it's very clear she's incompetent, and there's a lot of questions regarding what she's doing in Broward County.
All right, let's see. Tomorrow, Saturday at noon, we're supposed to get the totals. Hopefully we can move forward from there. Lisa, thanks.
Thanks, Brian. Have a good night.
Context of white supremacy. It took me a few seconds to get my microphone adjusted. That no good Brenda Snipes. She messed up my headset before we got started. Whew. Gusty Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 10, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions. If you have thoughts on any of the news segments that we just heard, certainly any of the other events that took place over the last week, dial in. Let us know. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Wowie. Things to get to before we get to the callers. Number one, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, my PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email and I will get you a physical mailing address. Enormous gratitude to all of the investors who have kept the context of white supremacy broadcasting for a decade. Hopefully the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Also, you can support the cows via my Amazon wish list. It's linked under Gus T. Renegade. It is also linked at my blog. Again, tremendous gratitude to all of the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list for roughly 10 years. I hope the context of white supremacy has provided accurate, constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what non-white people, victims of white supremacy, can do to solve this problem. Other things to get to before we get to the callers. Over the 10 years that we've been on the program, many of our listeners and even guests have pointed out the importance of paying attention to patterns, things that we see repeatedly. It can be our own behavior patterns of others, particularly behavior patterns of racists, whites. One of the behavior patterns that a listener pointed out was that there is a tendency, number one, victims of racism, white supremacy, are not experts on racism. We are all still confused about racism. But one listener pointed out to the tendency that they have noted and even observed it quite a bit on this broadcast is the tendency for victims of racism, non-white people, to be very arrogant in our understanding of racism, particularly when we're talking to other non-white people. Very arrogant, very confident, very self-assured about, you know, our expertise on racism, frequently arrogant and in error. That was one. A listener pointed that out on the program and has even called in, I think, more than once to point that out when that has happened. I'm just pointing that out at this moment because we had Dr. Marvin Dunn on the program, I think, the first or when he was on last week. The very beginning of the program, I used the term uppity, being joking man, if you hear, he was, you know, giggling about it, and even I think acknowledged that he is uppity. You can hear it in the archives. But he was being uppity about Andrew Gillum, black male, winning the governor's race in Florida. He was in error, obviously, even with the recount. He was in error. Just pointing that out, I did think that that was significant, and it did, once again, our pattern. Sticking with the Florida situation, you heard retired firefighter yesterday. We were doing our discussion on workplace racism. Towards the end of the broadcast, he was talking about how they were blaming a lot of what was happening on Brenda Snipes, who also messed up my headset, and saying that this black female down in Broward County, it's her fault. She messed up, you know, the ballots, and she might be messing it up for Mr. Governor Scott, who's trying to become United States Senator Scott, might have messed it up for Mr. Gillum, too, in a state that is notorious for, how shall I say, election peculiarities, to put it mildly, a state that is notorious for that, that this time they find a black person and say, oh, yeah, it's her fault. She messed it up. Oh, yeah. Messed up and has been incompetent for a long time. Can't believe that she's got, and I think racists, they have done a particularly sparkling job with the situation in Florida. Lots of racial theater, get everybody all excited and pretend that Andrew Gillum is going to win and all of that, and then blame it on this black female. But they had photographs. I'm thinking of Yahoo specifically. They had photographs where she just looked really disheveled. And it's not at all like, you know, you need to come and have your most glamorous profile picture for the press. But I am sure that Miss Snipes, Dr. Snipes, I'm sure that she has, you know, her proper professional photographs that are available, even recent photographs taken within, you know, this last week or so, where she's looking professional and answering questions or what have you. But racists, in my view, they like to get those photographs of us looking disheveled, especially when they're going to blame us for something. I think Ivy had pointed that out. They did this with Congresswoman Waters recently. They would get a picture of her looking really wild and put that up. Oh, man, yeah, that Congresswoman, you know, Waters, Trump is right about that one. Man, how's she in office? But really tacky way that they conducted the campaign in general, and specifically with the Young Turks. We've talked about them for years on the program. We've listened to a lot of their segments. Either, at minimum, I would have to say, okay, you all don't know what you're talking about. It would have to be, hey, if we were on this platform in any way sounding like Andrew Gillum is going to win or giving that impression, wow, we didn't know what we were talking about at all. We should stop and reflect and make sure that we're not on here giving out bad information about, you know, what people should be expecting in the election. They study politics. I said that this past week. I don't study politics. I study racism, white supremacy. They study politics. They talk about politics all the time. They should have been accurate on who is going to win Georgia and Florida, not, you know, hopes and dreams and all that. You can say all that. And then it should be, hey, I don't think Mr. Gillum is going to win Florida. So if you're with him, you had better get out and get your friends and uncles and cousins and go out and make new friends and get all of them to go vote, absentee ballot or whatever it is, because, man, I don't think it's going to happen. You better get, you know, that's the way it should have sounded. That's first. But then, at least for me, as I listened, I don't think that's the case. I think this is whites practicing deception. They do that a lot, disseminating incorrect, I can't even call it information, just disseminating falsehoods on a variety of different platforms, especially about the elections, but really, you know, about anything. Just in the way that they talked about that situation, like, oh, my goodness, I can't believe. In fact, I can point to one thing specifically. They said so many times in the segment that Ron DeSantis, suspected racist next governor of Florida, that he called Andrew Gillum a monkey. He did not. He said, let's not monkey this up and vote for Mr. Gillum. In my view, that is a substantial difference, what Mr. DeSantis actually said and just saying that he called him a monkey. I and many others talked about that statement being, you know, an act of racism, white supremacy, that I would not paraphrase or just shorthand it and say, oh, yeah, he called him a monkey. That's not accurate. That's not codified. And I could see a lot of racists saying that, hey, that's not, you're not even being accurate in the way that you are presenting information. You know, just going ahead and to go along with your narrative and make it seem like, oh, yeah, this guy just came out on stage and called him a monkey and then everyone voted for him. And that's not what happened at all. But even just going into the details about what happened and why this could happen, I can't believe this. In the state of Florida? Really? Did you read Dr. Dunn's book? Have you, I mean, you all are supposed to be politicians. Really? You're surprised that this happened in Florida? I thought Donald Trump won the state of Florida just 2 years ago. You thought that many things changed over the last, what, 18, 24 months since he's been in office? Again, if you're that disconnected that you can't look at this and come to an accurate conclusion, you should just come out and say that. Maybe we're not qualified to even have this post to come out here and giving you wrong information again, because so many people did that in 2016. I don't think that's what it is. I think they just come out on these platforms and lie, particularly that one. Just with the word progressive, what does that even mean? Progressive candidates, Mr. Gillum, progressives, Ms. Abrams, and so shocked that they didn't win. It is utter nonsense. You cannot be a white person and be ignorant about racism, white supremacy. And in fact, to point to another one for Sink in that segment to say, Well, the area that I grew up, it was so, you know, multicultural. That's another one. It was so multicultural. We just didn't have any racism. And he says, well, I'm sure there was some, but I mean, we just didn't have any racism to even make a statement like that. I mean, really, any time, 2018 or any time, but he's talking about when he grew up. So you would have to rewind to go back, what, 30 years minimum we'd be talking? That is absurd. Any part of the universe. And he said, oh, no, we didn't have any racism. No problems there. The Negroes were treated extraordinarily well. I mean, whew, best environment that you can imagine. Come on now. Out and out. Lies. I've talked about the Young Turks. That is a great illustration of all that I say in terms of how they promote racism, white supremacy, and even with the black female and the commentary that she had, it's so far. VGQ, she can say what she wants, victims guaranteed, qualified, but it's so far beyond just I'm followed in a store. And I mean, really just getting to the core of what racism, white supremacy is and how it works. And again, black people are not experts on racism. That is not the problem, in my view. White people having a problem accepting that black people are the experts on anti-black racism. That's not the problem at all. White people just like to lie about racism, white supremacy. And oh my gosh, I can't believe that Mr. DeSantis won by just coming out and calling niggers monkeys. I can't believe that that happened. Yeah. Continuing. That Oregon segment was fascinating. I do try to include segments that address the Pacific Northwest, since that's right, you know, where I am. Portland is, I think, 3 hours from Seattle driving. And I think they're trying to construct a train where you can get there even faster. But that segment, Oregon Sounds Like Freedom. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. That is amazing that at any point that there were victims of racism who their situation was so bad. Man, if we could just get to Oregon, where they had it in their state constitution, and I don't think it was ever repealed, so it might still be there. No Negroes in the Oregon Territory, a part of the official state constitution. And I think it was, you could be lashed if a Negro was caught in the state of Oregon. And the white people caught you. I think you could be lashed for a certain amount. I think there was incarceration to it and a lashing. I think they had pretty staunch penalties for Negroes having the audacity to migrate to this area of the world. But I thought that was why. And I've heard that so many times before. Warmth of Other Suns, Isabel Wilkerson, she writes a lot about that. Black people thinking that there was some place they could go, like maybe they could find where Sink's childhood neighborhood is, where there's no racism, no such place. The segment where they were talking with what I suspect were white mothers, and they were talking about the opioid addiction, I suspect they were white. That segment had no video, so I'm just going by voice. I could be wrong, but I thought they were white moms that they were talking to. I contrast that to the segment that we just were talking about with the black mothers who had doctor's notes and were just trying to get reduced work detail so that they didn't have to carry and hoist 50 and 75 pound boxes while they were pregnant, and they were told to shut up and get back to work unless they wanted to be fired. Where these white women addicts are being sympathized for a gang, and oh yes, let's make sure that we don't, you know, have them relapse, and we'll be more careful with their meds. It's not talk of, oh man, we need to lock them up and, you know, make sure they're handcuffed to the bed and that sort of, not that sort of dialogue at all. And in fact, I even paid attention to the words. This is the compensatory call-in where one of the women that I suspect is a racist, she was talking about going through this process and she didn't want to be high. And she said having her child, she felt reborn, invoking the language of the religion of white supremacy, not Jesus, I guess, but the feminine Mary, an immaculate conception. I have been reborn, the religion of white supremacy. White people always come out pure and innocent, even when they are cracked up, thieving, whatever it is, they are innocent, pure, just like blue-eyed white Jesus. other terms that came up in the segment, the phrasing on the margin, the term marginalized, as well as the phrasing on the margin, I think both of those are particularly niggardly phrases, and I'm using that specifically. They're very cheap, very tacky ways of articulating what is white terrorism. I don't even know what that means. Well, on the margin, is there, a nigger drawn on the side of a piece of paper? What are we talking about? On the margin. Be specific. Be precise when we are using words to describe the system of white supremacy racism. Marginalized, on the margin, those phrases do not accurately describe anything. I would encourage us to desist from using those terms or phrases immediately. Similar thinking, this is the compensatory call-in for this program specifically. I request if we could not use metaphors, and I have to be mindful myself, racists, they will reborn. They will use metaphors regularly to support the system of white supremacy. Another aspect or another tactic is they'll use metaphors, similes, to practice deception. They will insist that two separate concepts are equivalent, identical, and frequently that is not the case at all. Victims of white supremacy, myself included, we've been exposed to this incorrect behavior, and many of us, we are still learning, and sometimes we will substitute a metaphor in place of logic as we're still trying to come to a conclusion. Frequently, this causes a lot of extra confusion. If we could make an effort to be specific, precise about what it is we're saying, I would appreciate it. I will prompt about that. Also, from this day forward, I do reserve the right to immediately mute anyone who calls me brother. Anywho, that's it. The number, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments. Again, if you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be appreciated. Just you can unmute, make whatever comments, questions that you would like to share, and then mute your line again. If you could take 5 minutes to share to make sure that everybody gets at least one chance to speak, and then once everyone's had their opportunity, if you have additional comments, then you can share again. But if you could use that mute button, that would be really appreciated just to make sure we don't have a lot of unnecessary background disruptions. Thank you kindly. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening, Gus.
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, sir. Greetings to all the callers. Always look at the money, funding, Gillum and Abrams. I've heard them call themselves, and people call them liberals and progressive, but they're pushing democratic socialism, like racist Bernie Sanders. Another country pushing democratic socialism right now is China, and they refined it to be called social credit. So I'm very wary of those people pushing that policy. Biological warfare, you had AIDS, chemical warfare, we had crack, GMO foods, GMO formula, GMO vegetables, designer fruit, but now plant viruses that make flies turn white, and then the flies pass the virus to healthy plants. And to fix this, of course, the white people have created GMO incense to carry another GMO virus that will fix it. It just sounds a lot like Zika, West Nile virus, that new malaria, the dengue. And then they got this wall batcher, I saw an article on this. It's called Wolbachia, W-O-L-B-A-C-H-I-A, which can be carried not only by flies and mosquitoes, but also by spiders, mites, and centipedes, other animals that crawl. So we see the next level that they're going to. The teacher who pushed the student or hit the student, had the fight with the student. I saw the video. It was a wow moment. The child looked like a non-white, non-black child. He called them nigger repeatedly. I wonder if the teacher did nothing with the penalty for the non-white, black child, non-white, non-black child that was calling him a nigger and assaulted him. Would that be considered a hate crime? I doubt it. And also, I wonder if Mr. Riley was an LGBT teacher and harassed and called fag over and over, would they have penalized him for retaliating? I wonder that as well. Video games, I mentioned this before. It's a game called Fortnite. It's very popular. It's one of those shooter games, 100 people put on the island with different weapons to kill each other. Groups of white people have worked together to kill off the non-white people, so they're the only ones left on the island to kill each other. They also have this new Black Ops game where I read an article where they're doing the same thing. Groups of white supremacists are teaming up, and they get to do this preemptively before they even start. They already put themselves on a team, and they're trying to win. Now, when they had the string of terrorist attacks in Europe, they were using PlayStation to communicate with each other and coordinate the attacks because it's not easily to detect it by law enforcement like social media because it's encrypted. The video games, being that these are expensive games, you put in your credit card information in there, they do not allow you to go and get into that site as easily. So a lot of people are using this to coordinate attacks, and that the white supremacists could do the same thing. The questions the Black reporters asked were not good. Did he call Little John or Uncle Tom, trying to bait him into claiming he's a white nationalist? She set herself up for that one. He's an expert at rhetoric and deflecting. He, just flipped that around on her. You can call me a racist. That's a racist question, Not smart. He said he's a U.S. nationalist. His campaign slogan was Make America Great Again. Duh, he's a nationalist, a white nationalist, a neo-Nazi, a skinhead. He never said he was that. Here we have the first president in my lifetime who's done or attempted to do every single thing he ran on. And the Black reporters don't try to get him to commit to doing anything for Black people. They want him to admit he's a racist, and he's not going to do it. I just wish they would stop it. Michelle said Trump's birth comment made her feel like her family wasn't safe. I just think that was ridiculous. He was a so-called Black man, African-American, running for the world's most powerful position president in the world's most racist country. I don't see how Donald Trump's statements did it. I mean, what about Sarah Palin's statements during the campaign? I mean, the Secret Service let people get on the elevator with them, hop the fence several times. One got to the door of one of the rooms. They let a man fly a helicopter on the White House lawn to deliver a bunch of mail from white people for him to resign. And her biggest fear was Trump's comments. I mean, last thing I wanted to say, I'm for building the wall against this caravan. If you're seeking refuge and you're trying to run from something happening to you, and you pass through one country and then to the next country, then to the next country, well, come on. How much refuge could you be seeking? You can't travel for thousands of miles by foot without food, water, and financing. Who's financing this thing? I could, tell you. But then you had NAFTA, which is why they're coming over here. Well, Trump ripped it up and renegotiated. It's over. So I think that he's sending the military there. They have to follow protocols and procedures. They have all types of non-lethal but very painful technologies, a heavy media presence observing. The alternative would be he let the people handle it themselves. That would be catastrophic. Now, I personally think that if he was to remove the military and the Border Patrol and say he'll let the militias of the states of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California handle it themselves, you'll see bipartisan legislation tomorrow to come up with a solution to the problem. But, you know, I think he's really giving them an out by sending the military there. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. I guess the same thing that I said on whatever day that we discussed the reporters speaking to Trump, I do think it's possible that those victims of racism who are asking the questions, that they could be being ordered to ask those specific questions. I think that is possible. I think that's what I said the other day. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I have been giving some thought to Dr. Snipes. Over the years, that particular report, the reporting that's been going on just recently, didn't just start. Because I'm thinking about, I'm pretty sure when she signed up or asked for the job that she wasn't really looking for some sort of celebrity status or something like that. Of course, income, that would be understandable, and maybe some sort of sense of duty would be understanding also, a combination of both. But I would say now that I figure she should be under some very, very high security, because I don't think that she can do the normal quote unquote normal things that people do, like go to the grocery store. Her face is quite known in the South Florida area. I would say by now, probably more than likely in a large part of this part of the world, period, that's called America, United, quote unquote, United States, but definitely in South Florida. And so just a thought, but that I had. Also, I would say honestly, and I would also accredit it as being a mistake on my behalf, that I could have saw myself doing the same thing or something very similar to that student as the, I believe, band teacher did. Probably even worse, actually, as far as that concerned, because it doesn't look like he physically hurt the student. At least they didn't report any type of damage, like a broken jaw or something like that. He was knocked unconscious or something like that. But it would have been a mistake. It would have been a mistake. I do think that Mr. Fuller's suggestions and examples of racism, white supremacy, as far as rhetoric, racist rhetoric, and it should be expected from white people. And in that case, I would say perhaps we shouldn't react in a violent way, or basically may not. It's different options. It's different options. You can say something, but in terms of a question, perhaps, or don't say anything at all would be a correct alternative. As far as they're concerned. But I would say, honestly, I could see myself doing something very similar, which I would deem would be incorrect to do. So that's something I probably have to work at as far as they're concerned. Something I probably have to work at, because it would be a situation where I would be guided more by emotions as opposed to thinking. And it should be something that definitely that non-white black people should expect, no matter what the age. That's irrelevant, actually, of a white person saying or doing things. But those are just some of my thoughts, and maybe I have a chance later on to speak some more. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I do think the perpetrator in the incident with the teacher, Mr. Riley, I do think that was a non-white student, non-white, non-black student. Just from what reports that I've read and the video, I could be in error about that. I think Thomas in New York commented about that too, him being a non-white student.
You know what? That does make sense, because when they panned the students, the other students at the school, just about all of them appeared to be non-white, non-black students. Even the ones that spoke up on his behalf, as far as they're concerned. But I would say that in that particular situation, it probably would have reduced the anxiety on my behalf, as far as that concerned, somewhat. Just being honest, and actually, other than maybe asking a question or ignoring the student, unless the student turned physical, as far as that concerned, I did hear that he threw some sort of object, a basketball. If he would have hit me with that basketball, throwing it, then that probably would have changed the whole position of me being nonviolent. I put it that way. Because I would say, because that actually is a could be considered to be an assault on his behalf. But I did observe that. That would change the my reaction as far as what I think on an immediate basis. But that's it. Thank you.
The student did strike the teacher with the basketball in that incident as well. It looked like the basketball made contact with the black educator. So
I would have made an immediate reaction, though. Immediate. His was not immediate. But anyway, I'm going to shut my mouth. Thank you.
Other folks who dialed in, should have included that on workplace racism. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed. While folks are lollygagging to get their comments, questions together, I don't know if Ms. Snipes has security in the Florida area. I seriously doubt it. Certainly not the level of security that I've seen some of these white enforcement officials get when they allege that their life is in jeopardy after they've shot and killed a black person. But I have seen her photograph of someone that I've never seen, like, ever. If you had asked me, like, two days ago, if you had asked me who Dr. Snipes is, or if you'd put her photograph up, can you pick it? No idea at all. I have seen her photograph more in the past, like, 48 hours, just on random sites, yeah, national sites, like, not just, you know, going to the Miami Herald or Florida publications, but nationwide, like, oh, yeah, it's her fault. She messed everything up. Why is she even working there? This is outrageous to have something this serious in the hands of this nigger woman down here in South Florida. What is going on? Just to have that play out on a national stage, like, wow. In one of the elections that they said all along, oh, yeah, everyone is watching this, like racial theater at its, I guess you'd say, best if from the racist perspective with the Dr. Snipes situation. The other folks, if you're still spectating, I reckon, if you have commentary, line should be open. Not sure we had something.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How's it going, Gus? This is Black Male Engineer. Couple things. Being in Florida, I was surprised that my county went blue. Duval County, highly surprised. Wasn't expecting that. Just with the how I see things in the city. Excuse me, let me try to get my notes. The head of elections in Broward County is a black female. That's just interesting to me because now I'm just confused as to whose side she's on, quote unquote. Like, is she helping out the Republicans or the Democrats? I mean, she's helping out white supremacists either way, but I would like to see Mr. Gillum win. And I'm not in, you know, it just seems like a giant misstep. There was also a poll done by CNN. I'm not sure how accurate this is. It is at this time. It said 18% of black women voted for DeSantis in Florida. So that was also interesting. On the subject of experts, black people being experts in teaching racism, from what I've seen and from the black female that said that, I've noticed that there are a lot of black females who tend to think that way. And just not black females, black females that are like in academia or who are feminists and talk about racism, they seem to and they do present the notion that they are experts on racism and that they just need to educate white people. And I've heard Dr. Curry talk about this quite a bit, especially with the way the academy is so lopsided gender-wise. And I don't know, I just find that whole dichotomy interesting, how, you know, they don't want men in the academy, and the women they have in there, they're not like Harriet Tubman's, you know, Asante Wise, Winnie Mandela's. They are, women who feel like you can talk to white people, you can talk white people out of racism. I feel like it's very dangerous, and it's a giant fallacy. I found out today that a 22-year-old black male was killed by the police in my area. He was shot in the back, I think in the back of the head. I forgot his name. I heard the story today. It was very, very sad. So I would just like to send some condolences to him and his family. And I think that's it for now. Thank you.
If you get his name, we can share information on Facebook or social media just so other people can get information. Sorry for that loss of life, but that is the global system of white terrorism. Other folks dial in, have commentary that they wanted to share. Wow. while I'm waiting for spectators, I did think the food segment where they were talking about the chemical and biological warfares, perhaps, I thought that was important, and even the color of the bugs that were attacking the plant, them being white, I thought that was significant as well. Michelle Obama's book, I had been talking about that before. I guess it'll be released this week. I've been talking about that like years in advance, like maybe they'll write a book, both of them, the Obamas, and they'll be able to present accurate information about all the racism and things that happen behind the scenes, like all the juicy tidbits. You know, once they're gone, they maybe have a little bit more freedom, as they say. Even have to pause myself. Those were quite a few metaphors, talking about the so-called black females in the academy, saying that they're not Winnie Mandelas or Harriet Tubmans. Those are all metaphors. No idea what that means. With the lost my train of thought going back to the metaphors. It will come to me in a moment. But, yeah, I did want to make sure I got that in. No metaphors for the broadcast. Try and be cognizant to prompt folks about that in the beginning. I was going to say something about one of the other clips, chemical and biological warfare. I did think that was important, and the color of the bugs that attack the plants being white, I thought that was significant as well. The segment where they were talking about the video games, I think the codified software developer in Wisconsin was just talking about her coworkers trying to get her to come and play one of those games online after work. I guess they found out, you know, she was in the games, so they're all tech type people anyway, so similar interests. But she was just talking about that. I think it was yesterday. She was just talking about that, and then they go into all of that there. I think she was saying that she was not going to get involved, being codified. She's not going to participate in any of that madness. But in that segment where the dad, suspected racist, where he said he found the white supremacist literature that his son had, and he was so, you know, upset that this was even in his house that he had to go to his room and cry, weeping white man. Oh, wow. He goes to his room and cries, and then he comes back, and we do all this, and now his son doesn't play video games as much, and it's now started church. I said, religion of white supremacy. And then I thought later on in the segments when they said that it was the white evangelicals, they don't think that there's a problem with police abusing Negroes. 75% of them, they don't think that's a real issue at all. So him going to church, that will solve the problem. Just the whole presentation of racism, white supremacy consistently will be it's these hate groups online, people that are, you know, overt, as opposed to just what does it mean to be white? Explaining how Ron DeSantis can win. Just explaining what it means to be white. That will, in my view, I think that will help you understand, process why these things happen. That is so critical. When you get a better understanding of racism, being able to process why these things happen. But yes, the segment where they were talking about the video games, critically important, and weeping white man. Sounded like we were talking about Dylann Roof, the way that he was describing his son, budding terrorist, no metaphor intended. Others dialed in with a hand up commentary you needed to share. Line should be open if we've not heard from you. While folks are waiting, I even see. Oh, did I miss somebody?
Yes, sir.
Oh, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. To speak about the video games, I know there was a YouTube channel. I think it was called M&M Twins or something like that, and they would, I guess the term that they use online is troll, I guess, and I guess they would make these montage videos of the racism that the white players would engage in and practice, and send them all kind of messages, and they'd be on the microphones calling them niggers and monkeys, apes, and stuff like that, and they would post it to YouTube. I haven't seen it in a while. It was a few years ago. I would see some of those videos, and some of those voices, they sounded as young as 12 or 10, very young, using that same kind of racist language. So that reminded me of that. As far as the black female in Broward County, I think the supervisor of elections, the lady that was doing that segment, that, like, that term she used, she used the word sketchy. I know I have wrote that word down. She used sketchy to describe, I guess, something I guess she was doing. So that's another word to kind of be mindful about, I would say, to victims. As far as the recount situation, I think Mr. Gillum, he did, I think, post on a Twitter. I guess he withdrew his concession or whatever. So I guess we're going to be waiting on an update on that. And with the, I think that was the black female speaking on the platform with the Young Turks. And I guess she was saying that, and of course VGQ, but she was saying, well, there's racists everywhere. But I think it would be more accurate to say there are white racists everywhere, because that could go into the area of just saying that everyone's racist, possibly, just to make sure that we're being accurate with the language. And I think it was a segment on where they were talking about the student that had that fought with the teacher, the black male teacher, and the reporter that was speaking on that situation over there, she or he was asking one of the, I guess, parents or something like that, well, did you want to criticize, or do you have any criticisms of a teacher? And she was like, oh, no. He was like, really? Really? You don't? Like, come on. Almost saying, like, I can't believe we have somebody actually agreeing with the black male who defended himself. So I thought that was very important, right? That was very interesting. And as far as the other reports, I'll have to think a little further on what I'm going to speak on those, and I'll just give it to the next person. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. Caller in Florida. That teacher situation reminded me, I don't know if folks remember or not, this was in Arizona, like 2 years ago. I think this was like 2016. It was a black male, and I think he was a substitute. Black male teacher. It was a white child this time. It's like a white 12-year-old. And this black guy looked big. Like, he was not in his 60s like Mr. Riley in this situation. He looked like, you know, he probably does some weightlifting or something. Like, he looked like he was physically fit. And this little white kid looked like he was about 12. And he goes in, look here, nigga, you're not going to, you know, tell me such and such. I don't care if I didn't do the homework assignment. They got video of this. And the black teacher walloped him. And I don't remember him getting like a big GoFundMe and all that. Like, Mr. Riley in this situation, they reported like he got a GoFundMe page and got like $100,000 and all the rest of it. I don't remember the substitute teacher from before getting all of the attention. I don't even remember in that situation whether or not he was arrested. I think as he was a substitute, so they didn't, you know, invite him back or what have you to teach. But I remember in that situation, there were also people, white people even, who were like, yeah, you can't be calling people niggers, and should have taught him better, and blah, blah, blah. Like, it was surprising. Like, there wasn't an immediate rush. Like, similar to this, there wasn't a rush to, oh, my gosh, I can't believe it. Put that nigger under the jail type of thing. It was – I have to – we talked about it on the program. I played several segments. I think it was back in 2016, no later than 2015. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I hope we do not have any listeners who are in the California area with the fire. Hopefully that is not impacting any cows listeners or non-white people, period, really. I heard with the report on the fires, and I guess there are multiple, if I'm understanding the reports correctly, the fires in California, that Simi Valley was one of the areas that was impacted by the fires. And I couldn't even invoke the concept, what they say, karma. I couldn't even invoke the concept of karma there because I wasn't sure if there were non-white people injured. And Mr. Fuller, I think I played the audio segment where he's talked about before, where they'll have, you know, fires or a flood or whatever it is in an area with a lot of whites, and they'll just gather and say, yeah, you know, we lost our house or whatever, but we got the dog, and, you know, we'll rebuild, got more niggers to mistreat, so we'll just get it back together. And about 6 months from now, it'll all be like Katrina. We read. They rebuild and just continue the practice of mistreating niggers. Other folks with commentary they wanted to share, we have not heard from you at all. Line should be open. Folks are hanging out for the veteran holiday. I guess that is going down. I should have said something about that on workplace racism, if people are having to have any sort of impact with that. I will ask a retired firefighter, do you think with the recount, do you think that that's going to stir up any, how shall I say, unnecessary confusion? I guess if I heard correctly, Mr. Gillum has rescinded his concession. So do you think this will now have what, another, could be 2 weeks, a month of confusion where Black people, victims of racism, are thinking they might have a chance to pull this out, or a good month of protesting on behalf of Mr. Gillum?
Oh, yes. The political atmosphere down here is, it seems to be heading towards almost the same emotional hope than what it was before the actual election itself. You hear of a total reassurance that quote unquote justice is going to prevail. And at the same time, what I'm observing is, okay, well, the same tactics and strategies that the racists did in order for this calamity to take place, they just do it again. The white male governor Scott has filed a lawsuit and won, and guess who the judge was? A white woman. Was a white woman that judged in his favor, and the governor-elect, quote-unquote, also with a notice of anger, was also stating about, and they're using as a code word for niggas, they're using the what's this term they call radicals. I just have to hear it again. If somebody said it, I would be able to recognize it. But they're using it as a substitute of saying niggas or something like that. They're repeating it, repeating it over and over again, that these blankety blanks are reshuffling the votes to work in their favor, that sort of thing, which is a similar strategy that the president has done, like Thomas said, in the advent when the black female raised the question about the president being a nationalist, and he quickly retorted back, "That's racist." Well, they have the governor and the former governor and the present governor. One is going for the Senate, the other is going for the governorship. They basically are stating some similar things. But yeah, the emotional activity is almost at the same height, from my notice, to answer your question.
Much obliged. That's been my observation. Racists like to have black people be very emotional, particularly around, as you call it, the professional voting process. I think whites already know that they have that whole thing taken care of, that's they know how to control that easily, especially in the state of Florida. I did want to make sure I mentioned, in terms of Dr. Snipes, there was a video with that segment. You could hear them when they were out chanting, "Lock her up." And they were calling her, I think they had changed her title to something like Supervisor of Corruption, I think is what they were chanting. But this was like a mob of whites outside with signs chanting, and they're all mad and yelling about this one black female, when retired firefighter, when he was saying that she, you know, might need protection. And I'm sure she didn't get into this job for a whole lot of, you know, celebrity and glamour opportunities. But I mean, to have a mob in Florida, of all places, stand your ground territory, saying, "Oh man, you stole the election. You stole out." There were people out with some of them saying signs saying, I found my vote under her bed and she's trying to steal the election from us. And the state, man, system of white supremacy. And absolutely, people talking about black people being in danger, the same state where Caesar Sayoc is sending package bombs to people. He said he was mad about Mr. Gillum as well. Oh my goodness, I cannot imagine the stress that black female, that victim is going through in the state of Florida. I cannot imagine. If I was her, I would be trying to get a vacation to get all of that done and over with so that I could vacate the premises as soon as possible. I could not even imagine having gangs of whites roving the streets, chanting my name, shouting, probably at least one or five of them armed.
Agreed. I don't see how she gets around, really. And she definitely can't do the normalcy, like I said, that other people do, like going to the grocery store, the post office, just even riding in her car and stop at a stoplight. You know, somebody would recognize her as far as they're concerned. And I wouldn't want to be in her position, that's for sure. If anybody needs prayer, she does, for her safety.
Amen. Almost Sunday. And I mean, I would say it's laughable, but it's not, because, I mean, it's serious what he's saying. But in a system of white supremacy, the audacity that something that's supposed to be important, right, this professional vote, what they say, vote or die, that something this important, that it could all come down to a black female fouled this up in a system of white supremacy. I mean, that I'm saying it is absolutely not possible. I'm saying this sort of thing is strategically, I take the position that until proven otherwise, this is deliberately done where they can, Mr. Fuller's concept of racial showcasing, where they can make it seem like the black person is out front. Might have black governors and black person here and black person there. They can put that black person out front and then put you out front. And at the exact same time, you're out front and you are to blame. It's your fault. We got to have somebody to take it. Going to be you on this one. Sorry, Dr. Snipes, but yep. So, all right. We'll just say it's your fault. that is the system of racism, white supremacy. It's so easy for them to do, really, any level. Mr. Fuller talks about Colin Powell, that situation, but it's so easy for them to do. And that's why I emphasize it does not benefit us. It's not logical to get upset at Dr. Snipes or any other victim of racism, white supremacy. The folks that are always most to blame, always, according to the evidence, every time, whites, racist man, racist woman, racist child. Dr. Snipes probably is as confused as the rest of us trying to figure this. Well, I did think Gillum was going to win. I wasn't, DeSantis. I thought he was going to win. I wasn't confused on that, but still trying to figure things out like everybody else. I'm sure Dr. Snipes just as confused as the rest of us with all of this, that somehow I am to blame for what has transpired here. Like, wow. Did the other folks have comments that they wanted to make sure that they got in?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yes. White people are always to blame. But my advice to the white people is to start teaching voting one-on-one in Florida. Just being facetious here. I notice a trend, though. In Florida, it's always the black county with the most blacks or the areas with the most blacks that have the hold up with the voting and the recount issues ever since 2000 with Gore versus Bush. And I also noticed as far as Atlanta, and I remember this happening in D.C., a few other places, it's always the quote-unquote black colleges that have voting issues and ballot problems. I've noticed a trend in both of those areas. I have a request. There's a show on television that my wife watches, and I find it to be extremely racist. The few times that I've been able to watch it with her, I've walked away with a smile on my face. It's so racist. It was well written. And the next time you have Dr. Kevorkian, I would love if he was to, if you could preemptively ask him his thoughts on the show. Maybe he could watch a few episodes and just talk about it. It's called Shameless, and it comes on Showtime. Extremely racist show. The last thing I wanted to say, and I sent this to the firefighter earlier this week. There's an article I read. It said Khloe Kardashian rocks a G-string and sexy shoe after Tristan Thompson cheating episode on Keeping Up with the Kardashians. So I clicked on the article to read more about it. So apparently Tristan Thompson, a black male who plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers, last time I checked, has a child with Khloe Kardashian, and before the child was born, he was caught cheating on her, and she had the child, and this episode, you know, they shoot this well in advance, I guess, was talking about the cheating incident. So the next day, she puts out this photo shoot with her in a G-string rolling around in mud. So I said, you know, this is a Welzer moment to Mr. Firefighter, because, I mean, that what's the odds of that? You know, the episode comes on where this black male cheated on you with a black female or a non-white female at least, and then you put out a sexy photo shoot rolling around in the mud. You know what I'm saying? I just thought that was a welding moment. I mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Remind folks, I know their favorite area, people activity, no Area 8 for the compensatory call-in. I know feverish victims abound. I am sure Tristan Thompson among them. Feverish, yes. But no Area 8 for the compensatory call-in, no entertainment either. I know those are some of folks' favorite areas of study down through the years, but we will have ample time to get to all of that, I am sure. Other folks, that is so – the fire smoke detector was misbehaving prior to us going live, and I didn't have an opportunity to correct it, so it's just been chattering in the background, trying to persevere. Other folks, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564 *243#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Others have commentary that they wanted to share.
Shasta, are you still displaced, sir?
Absolutely.
Unbelievable. Well, very believable, but unbelievable. Wow. I mean, you thought by what they told you, August, it's going into Thanksgiving season. I could see the ball dropping and you still being there. It's unbelievable. Wow.
A year. An entire year. I think about that every day. An absolute year. It'll be in basically 30 days of flood victimization and displacement. I thought about this this week. If I had known this time last, or I guess not quite, but if I had known at the beginning of the year in January that I would still be displaced as a result of the flood come November, the cows would not have come back on the air until probably April or May. I would have taken 2 or 3 months to just let that sink in and just taken yoga classes and thought about being flood victim for the next year. I was moving through all of that thinking, oh, yeah, August, that's what they said, August at the latest, September-ish. Persevering. Victim of white supremacy, and I am sure there are not, I mean, that is what the system of white supremacy is about, having non-white people in these types of situations worldwide, perilous housing situation, not knowing where you're going to be able to stay at, just total disarray where you can't really think correctly, can't really plan correctly. That is what the system of white supremacy deliberately produces for non-white people, especially black people worldwide. Other folks had commentary they needed to get in. Lots of spec, I would think, with all of the hubbub and historic elections that went down, I would think folks would have had more commentary. But spectating, we should not have spectators with regards to counter-racism. We've had a lot of that already. Any folks else have commentary they needed to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. There was some comments that was said on the audio segments. Once again on that, the Young Turks. Did you catch where the, I don't know if that was a white man that was on there that was saying that, well, we just need to get to a point where how we got to realize how Trump views black people and brown people and whoever this guy's people is. Was he talking to Sink? I think, is that what his name is, Jink or something? Or did you hear that part of the segment?
I say Sink. Sink, that's what I say.
And I was wondering, white person when he said that?
I think he was in the clip because I think they had different points in the segment, the Young Turks segment, where the white guy that was speaking, he was saying basically like the Republicans, they don't care. Like, I think the point that you're making, they don't care. They don't care about black people or any of the non-white people. And then it was like he was looking at Sink and saying, whatever he is, he's close enough. That was one where I think they were saying he's not white. I think even when, if it's Sink, if that's how you say it, when he was talking about growing up, wherever he lived growing up, where he said there was no racism, I think even there, he made a statement of some sort that he was not white. So I think there were a few different times in the segment where somebody or he himself made a statement that he's not white.
Okay, because I was wondering who he had addressed that to. And it was also, I think, that same white person that was talking about, I think, the situation of the elections in Georgia and here in Florida. They were saying that they voted for
candidates that were weak. I think he used the term weak and corrupted. And I'm like, if he did use the term weak, I'm like, that's inaccurate, because they got a substantial amount of votes to defeat the black opponent or whatever. So how is the person weak? Yeah, I don't know what they meant by that, or corrupted. Instead of saying racist, it just seemed like they was trying to use a lot of words and indirect terms to describe the white candidates in both Georgia and Florida. And then there was a comment also made about, I guess, rural areas and the Florida area. So I don't know what was meant by that as well. It was once again just trying to make it seem like racism is just in small little pieces and parts, and it's just not the case at all. It's not the truth. And then just to speak on that, that video game channel, there was a guy that sent the black male twins. He sent them a voicemail, and he was like, why don't you come up to New Jersey and I'll hang you in my front yard? Okay, these are people sending their voices now, and they're typing these messages, and is calling them a nigger and everything. So it's very profound and very revealing. And that's all I have.
Wow, I am not a gamer, as they say, but I have known quite a few. And wow, I mean, the racism, white supremacy is stark. For all of the platforms and playing that I have observed, like, none of that surprised me. If they're sending messages, texts, any and all of it, it is amazing. I've seen where people, they just come on just with the intent. They're not even there to play the game. They are there. Their number one priority is practicing racism. That's what they're there for. Like, it's flagrant what their, you know, number one concern is. Is my line distorted? I guess just seeing the folks that are hearing me, am I coming through clear? Or does it sound like something is, my line is distorted other than the smoke detector?
Yeah, I hear you pretty good.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I'd got a message, one of our listeners, thank you kindly, said that it sounded like there might have been some distortion, but I was listening for at least while the audio segment, I was listening to the live stream, and that sounded okay. So let me know if it sounds like something is awry with my line. I will just say, with the questions that President Trump was asked, I think those environments are so controlled. Like, they just threw one of the reporters out this week, right? They revoked his credentials. Like, they don't just let anybody in there to ask questions, unless it's a nigra in the White House, except for that time. They don't just allow anybody there, and they don't just allow anybody to get up and ask questions. Even when he said, President Trump, when he said you had your question written down, to me, that sort of thing suggests that if another white person didn't write it down, like, oh yeah, this is the question that you're going to ask, at least they already knew what the question was going to be. If it was written down, like, someone else, you know, has already seen, like, oh, okay, this is what this nigger is gonna ask today. Okay. Like, that's just how I view it, that it just the optics of him being able to do that, where he gets an opportunity to do exactly what Thomas said, do his rhetoric. That's a racist question. You're a racist question. Come up here and ask me some. Black people love me. Have you seen my statistics? Just come in here and ask racist questions. Next, Little John. Okay. And just, so same thing, Dr. Snipes in Florida, and the incident with the black journalists asking questions. All of that, in my view, sounds very scripted. Racism, white supremacy, and what they would want to project about black people, both what their concerns are and white people being able to easily blame them for things. Easily move aside their accusations of racism. Same thing in Florida when Gillum tried to accuse DeSantis of being racist or what have you. Same thing. Knock that aside. No problem. Black people accusing us of being racist, or even sounding like they want to get to that. No problem. We got an A+ and moving that aside easily. DeSantis and Trump. We can show you in two different ways. Other folks have commentary? Anything else they wanted to make sure they get in? The caller at 9029. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Greetings to the callers. Greetings to the listeners. And thank you again, Gus, for the platform. First off, I start off with Shirley Chisholm. I kind of, I admit I'm not, due to system white supremacy, I have very little information on Shirley Chisholm, even being mainly Brooklyn being the main area where I was housed and stayed. I kind of did appreciate the information in regards to her. It does make me want to spend a little bit more time looking into some more of the things that she did while she was in office. But also, I was kind of surprised about her commentary when she stated the biggest hurdle that she had was her gender and not her race. If I'm correct, I believe that's what I heard. I was kind of surprised to hear that. And I would kind of like to hear more commentary, so I'll find out a little bit more in regards to that. Young Turks, I'm not really too surprised, but I feel like the Young Turks, in essence, they're a very dangerous program. And I say that because hearing them speak, you actually think that they actually have some real knowledge, that they're trying to figure out things, they're trying to get to the core, or sorry, that's a metaphor, trying to get to the exact issues and deal with them and address them appropriately. But even with the non-white female, VGQ to her, but some of the things she said is kind of dangerous. I mean, she stated America, one of the ongoing themes is America not listening to black people when we speak. I mean, and saying that is on one side good, but then the other aspect of it, she's not addressing why America doesn't listen to us. And I think that's ultimately really the most important thing. And America doesn't care. That's the reason why America doesn't listen to us. And that's very simple. But then the other aspect of the statement that I did appreciate that she did mention, I wish she could have expounded on more, was a statement about the Florida Senate governor running, and him being, he wasn't called a monkey, that is correct, but insinuated. It was insinuated by the statement by Santos. So she stated that it's kind of painful to hear that, as many other black people are trying to deal with that kind of those statements and those times when you're being treated and subjugated verbally or physically. And this is a thing what she was trying to state was, even when it's verbally, it still hurts the massive amount of black people, because we still hear these statements coming out of senators, governors, presidents, firefighters, you name it. They still are disparaging, and it does hurt mentally to hear that. And I wish that could have been expounded upon. I think that's a very serious issue that we don't address and deal with, along with our fear. That being said, Florida, I'm just not surprised. I don't. And again, this goes back to Young Turks. Again, why they're so dangerous with their information is just like, how could they not know? Like this, I mean, historically, this state was just. It hasn't had a good record. I mean, this is a state where they used to feed young black children to alligators, right? And they would have alligator postcards. I mean, I'm not even sure. They may still do for all we know, but this is a state that has been historically drenched with issues. I mean, ever since the days of Andrew Jackson going down there. So all these things come into play. I listen to Young Turks from time to time, but it's very hard to listen to them not knowing, but just being less confused and hearing some of their statements. That being said, that's all the commentary I have for now. I will mute my line. Thank you.
Many victims of that's one of the reasons that I continue to play segments from the Young Turks, because I know a lot of victims of racism listen to the Young Turks and think, you know, sink in company are not racist. They are, quote unquote, progressive and talking about racial issues. And, you know, this is a place where I can go and get information. And I've, you know, said consistently for years now, for that reason, a part of the danger that they represent in my view. And in my view, it becomes especially stark when you have an accurate understanding of racism, white supremacy, a definition of racism, white supremacy. It becomes particularly stark what they are doing on their program. Absolutely correct. It's not possible, in my view, for them to be that ignorant. White people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. They're whites on that show. In fact, the one moment I did think was significant, Anna Kasparian, the white woman, when they were talking, I'm like, oh man, I can't believe that, you know, whites would vote for, you know, DeSantis and Governor Scott in Florida. I can't believe that they would do this. This isn't even in their own interest. He talked about that with Dr. Dunn. I talked about that with Dr. Dunn, not being surprised about that. And she was like, you know, they're not doing well. Like you said, rural areas, they're not doing well. We're not doing well. A certain segment of the population is doing well, but we're not. And Anna, the white woman, she stopped him and she says, oh, I'm doing well. If I look at my own personal situation, I mean, I got a job, I got health benefits, live in California, great place. Hey, I'm doing great. And I think that white woman, I think, is in a tragic arrangement. Just based on some of her statements, I would have to investigate. That's not one that I can confirm, but just based on some of the programs that I've heard, I think she has talked about being in a tragic arrangement. Anyway, she said, yeah, I'm not, you know, having a lot of problems as a result of Donald Trump being president. Maybe some other people are, but I am not. And I thought that was significant because I think they regularly try to take on the perspective that they are also victims, that we empathize. We're with you, non-white people, black people. We understand your burden when that is not the case at all. These are whites and she has a nice, great job with all those benefits and what have you, providing disinformation, inaccurate information or inaccurate details about what racism, white supremacy is and how it works on pretty much a daily basis because they broadcast daily. Did other folks have commentary that they wanted to share? Oh, Shirley Chisholm.
Yes.
There was a question about Shirley Chisholm. So if folks had commentary on that and her statement about her being a woman being a bigger obstacle than racism, that would be appreciated. Proceed, retired firefighter.
I would have liked to, I heard that part when you were playing it before the program started. I would have liked to have heard her explanation of that comment because in my opinion, I don't think it's logical under a global system of racist white supremacy. But I also would say VGQ, if that is what Ms. Chisholm said, she has a right to make that statement. Years ago in Washington, D.C., met her on an elevator. It was something like back in the 80s, I think. Yeah, VGQ. And but I do think that I take the position that racism, white supremacy supersedes quote unquote gender. The addition that I had to report was God, darn it, I just slipped my mind again. The DCS program actually last weekend met Colin Kaepernick. He has some kind of program that's called I Know My Rights. That's what they call in these days and time a hashtag. Yeah, because I didn't go. I didn't go. Even if I could have gone, I wouldn't have wanted to go. You know, as far as that concerned, just something almost instinctive that would have told me that that's not an interest. It would have been an interest of mine. The whole idea about personalities is concerned. Maybe that's something he has to do. I don't know. I do think that he, of course, he got fired from the NFL and got hired by Nike. I really don't know the difference between the two, to tell you the truth. I really don't know the difference between the two institutions. I've actually been to the Nike world headquarters twice on what they call 7-on-7 tournaments, where our quarterback, Teddy Bridgewater, as you know, is in the NFL. We won both of those championships, and I had the chance to observe the whole settings out there. And what you have the type of white person that is, I would say, if you look up arrogant in the dictionary, you will see one of their faces, one of the employees that worked for the Nike headquarters out there in Oregon. Yes, other than that, just today, and this is something that is typical of the DCS mentoring program, to whereas the a lot of the attempted mothers are almost they almost show a sense of desperation involving their male children, and we have them as young as I would say 6 to 8 years old, as young as that, up to around 16, maybe 17, in that range. And I actually sat down with a attempted mother today who had tears in her eyes, tears coming out of her eyes and everything, about the desperation of her, of someone helping her with her male child, and this black male child probably wasn't older than about 8-9 years old, something like that. And that's based on my report for today. Thank you.
Important work with the program. Being an attempted parent is extremely difficult. I do not have children, but wow, that is difficult. Racists make it difficult. And I don't think, regardless of how the Florida gubernatorial race had been decided, I don't think her job would have been any easier until the system of white supremacy is replaced. But commendable work going out and trying to help out the young people. I reckon some of the listeners might be disgruntled that you didn't take a chance to go hang out with Colin Kaepernick for a sec or get a photo photo opportunity or what have you. But you know, can't say I'm upset about that one.
No interest at all. I've been around football since 1970, and I'm 60 years old, either as a player or a coach. The only reason why people coach because they can't play it anymore. As far as the political aspects of the sport, I have very little or no interest in it at all. As far as the part that doesn't have, I put it this way. The stuff with it goes with personality and all that kind of stuff. I don't have an interest in it at all, as far as they're concerned. So, I mean, and especially from the standpoint that, oh, yeah, the security. You actually had to have some kind of security clearance, I think Mr. Clark was stating. For some reason, I didn't qualify. He may not have qualified either, because he didn't go directly to this meeting. He basically, it was a couple of boys who did not qualify for some reason. He chose to just take them to somewhere and to make them feel that somebody is paying attention to them and you know, and turn the other boys over to the particular setting with another quote unquote mentor. And that's how things went week before last, weekend before last.
Wow, security clearance. That's, I don't know, to meet a, mm-hmm. a football player. I mean, no, the VGQ, no disrespect to Mr. Kaepernick at
very
all.
Very strange, very strange.
I've never heard that, security clearance to meet a football player. I've met an athlete or two in my life. Shaquille O'Neal came to the comedy club where I work now. That's not even the same sport, but I don't remember anyone needing security clearance to go and say, you know, how do Shaq? I don't, wow. But he's not Colin Kaepernick. He wasn't taking a knee. So
he was stating to me, Mr. Clark was stating to me that people would call him representing this, whatever this organization is. And they would say one thing, then the next thing, it'd be a different directive and some other different directive. You're right. I mean, it is quite baffling to understand. I wouldn't even put my time and energy towards understanding as far as that concerned. Nobody is that worth it to physically meet. You know, I don't have anything against them personally, anything like that, VGQ, but I mean, no way. I wouldn't be even be remotely interested, you know, as far as that concerned. You know, if I had to go through all of that.
Turning away high schools. I don't know what you could do to violate security in high school. That's wow. Did other folks?
Some of the boys is like I said, 7-8 years old.
Man,
7-8 years old. You know, he doesn't just have high school age boys. He has boys on the elementary school level. In this program, as well as with the middle school level, mm. you know, all ages.
Yeah. Wowee. I have been informed. I'll be mindful if I ever get a chance to meet him. Was there someone, other folks who had commentary that they wanted to share?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, in regards to the work our firefighter is doing, that's great. It's just going to be necessary for us to reach out more to the youth more than anything else. I think that's one of the most important things we can do. And that being said, I can easily see those attempted parents doing whatever it takes to try to make sure their children stay on the right path, because once our offspring enter school, the schooling system, which they dominate and control, it is, they may not know how to articulate their gripes and their concerns and issues, but the reality is that the children feel and sense their subjugation. They may not be able to explain it at that age, and that's what they're probably seeking. They're seeking ways to express it, and sometimes it unfortunately comes out violently. I could remember as early when I was younger and feeling frustrated and angry, and that's a dangerous place to be as a young child, especially a teenager, angry, walking around these streets. It's very dangerous. That misplaced anger could land you somewhere that your life may be even more of danger later on. So that being said, I tip my hat to you for that. As far as Kaepernick, you know, VGQ, we don't know what goes on. But I do think that in order for us to do stuff that we do as far as even this program, I think that people like him, it's a strange balance. I feel like some polar opposites even where, you know, he's getting that attention and we're aware logically that him getting that attention means that the dominant society, quote unquote, white people have said that this guy is safe. And I don't know logically if we're supposed to take down the system, if we should be viewed as safe to them. That's a tricky thing. Also, there was a book in the book club that wasn't in the book club, but it was, I don't know if you might remember this, Gus. It was a football player that you had on the show, and he had, I think it was called The Slavery Side of Sunday. He was dealing with black athletes, mainly football players that were, you know, how they get subjugated and treated improperly on multiple levels, you know, and how they're taken advantage of as well, especially economically, but also like physically, like their images and how they're portrayed on TV. I'm not sure if you remember the book. Do you recall that? Because I've actually been trying to find that one.
Yes, sir. Anthony Pryor is the male's name, former NFL player and author. And the book, The Slave Side of Sunday, he has a couple books that deal with football and racism, but that's the most prominent one, The Slave Side of Sunday. And his books are notoriously difficult to obtain. He knows this. He did them independently so he didn't go through like a huge white publishing company to get his work done. So they're not readily available in like Amazon or the other mainstream outlets. So frequently what'll happen, I think he goes out and he'll sell the books for a reasonable price. We'll say, you know, $25. He'll go out, he'll do some signings or what have you, but this is just like him basically going out and selling some books. So let's even say he sells, you know, 50, 100 books, you know, a weekend. That's a small number of books in circulation. So people will get those and then they'll post them on Amazon or what have you and sell them for like, you know, $300, $400. So for years, I've told him and he did not give me a suggestion to make it any easier for people to get the books. He's aware of the situation and does try to get out to sell them, but notoriously difficult to obtain. I read the copy that I needed to prepare for the program. I got a copy from the library. So hard to find, generally can be expensive.
That book is on Amazon. I just looked and it's for $224.
That's what I would
think.
Yeah. But it's been for years. People have done that with some of the other books as well. I think some people have said that they've seen copies of Dr. Welsing's ISIS papers on Amazon for that sort of price. Some of the other black books that might have constructive information. But yeah, it's a shame it's not more easily accessible because I think Slave Side of Sunday does have great info. The person that called 9706, did you have commentary?
Hey Gus, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Eric calling from Pittsburgh. Just to touch on a few, I guess, things that happened or just transpired this week. I know you guys talked about Trump's recent press conference. You know, I saw the press conference, and I was actually around your area in Seattle when I saw that press conference in the morning, and that was a pure display of confusion. I definitely felt that it was, I wouldn't say scripted, but like you mentioned, you know, a lot of the reporters that are allowed in that room are heavily vetted. And the room is, for the most part, controlled, for sure. So anything that would transpire in that room is fairly controlled and, in a way, I wouldn't say predicted, but for sure there's not much allowance for things that, I guess would be completely egregious to display on live television beyond what they would want to display, even though I think many people would say that Trump's actions during that during that press conference is within itself egregious. Also, to the recent elections, you know, I paid attention, like many victims of white supremacy, definitely probably paid attention to the elections. I noticed post the election, after the results came out, you know, even before the actual results actually coming out, there were a lot of discussions and debates around like black people not voting. You know, it seemed to be that black people, you know, were maybe split on the idea of participating in the election versus those that want to participate in this election for a variety of reasons, stemming from our ancestors, dying for us to vote, or whatever it is, Trayvon Martin wanting us to vote, whatever the reasons are, I definitely saw that there was a split or a bit of a divide. And then even post-election, when the results came out, I felt that a lot of black people who chose not to vote were being essentially blamed for whatever the results transpired with the election. And I thought that was very interesting. And I also noticed that black men in particular were being blamed for not being equals in terms of voting at the same rate or in terms of the same number as their black female counterparts. And I did notice that Dr. Tommy Curry called that out on his social media accounts, stating that, you know, those differences are statistically insignificant, which basically leaves room for chance as to why black men voted in lesser numbers democratically than black females. So when I see statistics that display the disparity between black female and black male voting democratically versus Republican, I definitely see that as a tool used to kind of divide black men and women or to foster that negative and non-constructive environment between black females and black males. And I also noticed that other racial ethnic groups, if you will, were left out on that particular statistic that was shown and thrown around through social media. It was a stat that kind of displayed Latino male and females, black male and female, white male and female, but other racial and ethnic groups were left out. And I thought that was very interesting how those other groups were left out, almost kind of centering the focus on black male voters who did not vote as much as their black female counterparts. And of course, this becomes a rallying cry for how black women might have this alleged black female magic or whatever. But nonetheless, this is just another tool to divide and create that negative or non-constructive environment between black males and females. And lastly, I noticed, you know, people using this statement, you know, if our votes didn't matter or don't matter, then why are they trying so hard to stop us from voting? And, you know, when I heard that statement, I kind of just glossed over it like many victims of white supremacy do. And when you hear terms thrown around, we don't take special attention to kind of stop and listen at every single word that's being mentioned. But I think the key word in that statement is they. And I think we have to start to define who is they, what does they mean exactly? And I noticed that, you know, when I first heard the statement, I kind of made the silly mistake of assuming that they was simply just, you know, all white supremacists, you know, regardless of party affiliation or how you denote yourself politically. But then I started to really whittle down and think about this in somewhat of a logical manner. And I came up with a more precise definition of what they might mean. And my definition, again, this is a BGQ moment for me, but my definition was white supremacists who denote themselves as Republican. And I think this leaves room for those who classify themselves as white and Democratic to also be white supremacists. One question I wanted to leave to you, Gus, was any word on updating your Apple podcast, I guess the Apple platform for your podcast? And if that's not, you know, something that you can fix, are there other platforms in which your episodes are being uploaded or streamed to other than the website and, I believe, SoundCloud?
Let's see. We are at Black Talk Radio Network. Mr. Fox has our archives at YouTube. We're also on Google Play, SoundCloud. That's at least four. And the iTunes is still not updating. That is beyond my control. I'm still working to hopefully get that corrected. It could just be direct racist interference, which there has been a lot of over the 10 years. If worse comes to worse, we can get a new iTunes feed. We've done that repeatedly before, at least this one I'd had for a while, so I'd like to see if I can get this corrected. But yeah, YouTube, SoundCloud, Black Talk Radio Network, Google Play, at least four other outlets, and I think all of those platforms, it should be up to date. Well, this episode obviously is not there, but everything up to yesterday, and workplace racism should be on all of the aforementioned platforms.
Cool. Noted. Thank you.
Indeed. And important, I think someone mentioned that if it was not today, one of our most recent broadcasts, they were saying that I think the caller today mentioned, I think it was like 18% of black females voted for DeSantis in Florida, as though it was their fault that made, you know, the slim difference, and Gillum would have won if all of them had voted for Gillum instead. And the black males didn't vote. They got a variety of ways. Dr. Snipes, black males, or just black people in general who didn't vote. I never hear the one whites who didn't vote. I suspect it's more white people in the state of Florida. So if we're talking about low voter turnout, a lot of white people don't vote too. It's never, where are the raggedy white people? The shiftless, no count whites who stayed home and didn't do anything. Why didn't they get out and vote? White Democratic voters who didn't get out, who say, I don't know, the niggers voting, got something good on TV. Yeah, I don't know if I'm gonna. I never hear them get, you know, harangued when the election. It's just the niggers are to blame. In a system of white supremacy, the niggers are to blame, and to find different ways of generating black conflict where black people can fight amongst themselves about whose fault it is that the election didn't, you know, go the way we wanted it to. Any final comments folks need to get in before we...
Can I say something?
Thomas, first? Thomas in New York.
Yeah, Mr. Well, I call him a racist, Bernie Sanders, earlier this week after the election, he said, there's no question that in Georgia and in Florida, racism reared its ugly head. And you have candidates who ran against Gillum and against Stacey Adams who were racist and were doing everything they could to play whites against blacks. And this is an outrage. We're going to have to continue to do everything we can to fight all forms of racism. And then, of course, he had to take that back. And he released this statement. Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum ran brilliant campaigns, created enormous excitement at the grassroots level, but running in states where there were tough states for Democrats. That's pretty much how he summed that up now. No mention of racism rearing its ugly head anymore. No mention of blaming the white supremacists. So I think that falls in line. Everyone else wants to blame blacks. He walks back his statement, and now that continues, not blaming the people who are most at fault.
Indeed. Brother Bernie Sanders. Falls in line. I think that is a metaphor, and previously we had down the right path, and tip of the hat, those would be metaphors as well. Did we have any final comments, thoughts folks needed to share before we conclude?
Can I be heard?
Caller in Florida?
Yes, sir. I was just thinking about, I know how security was mentioned about protecting the black female. And I thought about how Richard Spencer, he got nearly $500,000 and law enforcement protection when he came to speak here at University of Florida. So since the Florida governor race is being mentioned, I think it's important to add that in there too. That was just last year. So he's more openly racist, white supremacist. So I think that's interesting right there too. And that's all I have.
Dr. Snipes is a civic official. Richard Spencer is connected with white hooligans who had just participated in committing crimes, including murder in the Union when he came to Florida, and they spent all that money to make sure that he was safe. I can't imagine that they've spent even a tenth of that bill on keeping Dr. Snipes safe. And it was a mob. You should watch that video for nothing else. It was a mob of what. Charlottesville, it is, in my view, it would be comparable. Anybody, if you saw the footage from Charlottesville, look at the mob that was out there chanting about Dr. Snipes, and they had their signs and everything, lock her up and everything else that they were comparable. We'll wrap there. That's pretty much 3 hours. We should be here. Admit, I can't even. Whatever the program is on Thursday, it's not workplace racism. The book club is Thursday, so that'd be Dr. Tommy Curry. It's going to take a while for my brain to process. The book club is no longer on Friday. It's on Thursday. The book club, Dr. Tommy Curry, the man not mentioned on the broadcast. We'll see if we can maybe get live commentary. That would be great to add. Black males being blamed for the election results. Black males not vote, or it was not voting democratically sufficiently for whichever election didn't go the correct way. But that's Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace racism Friday. We will probably have other broadcasts. Just check Black Talk Radio Network and or the Facebook page for updates about upcoming broadcasts. And hopefully we can get the iTunes fixed. We'll have that updated as well. With that, much obliged to the folks who dialed in and did not spectate. Much obliged. Hope be leery. Lots of incorrect information about the election and many other things. That is a major part of your job as an attempted counter-racist, to really investigate and make sure that you're getting accurate information. Racists, they do a phenomenal job of disseminating poor quality rubbish and passing that off as info to Black people especially. Be mindful. With that, much obliged for folks tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Race soldiers have taken advantage of many Black people who were not thinking correctly because we were under the influence. One of the best things we could do, Dr. Welsing would encourage, let's be sober so we can make phenomenal decisions and quickly get about the business of solving this problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we're in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.